Citation Needed by Elwyn Year and Festive Ferret, read by Cookie Mom 6067. Chapter 1. Tony stacked one coffee cup on the other to push open the door to Smith Library. He tried to wrangle his phone out of his pocket to check the time without knocking his bag off his shoulder as he wiggled through the broken turnstile, but the coffee tower threatened to collapse, so he gave up with a frustrated huff. He wrapped his hand around the seam between the two cups and tipped them both up so he could take a sip off the top one. It was too hot, but the psychosomatic response to the caffeine still felt like a light switch flipping on. He marched through the stacks on his way to Pepper's office, but as he passed row 206, a familiar head of brown hair halted him in his tracks. "Darcy Lewis," he called. Darcy froze, winced, and huffed out, "Shit," under her breath. "Yeah, you better swear." Tony spun on his heel and marched down the road to where Darcy was now looking resigned to her fate. "You know what I'm going to say, and you also know I have to say it anyway." She sighed. "Yeah, better to get it over with, I guess." "You forgot about France." "I know," she whined. "It's a draft, Dr. Stark. It's an entire country. You said it didn't need to be complete." Tony shifted his copies around so he could take another sip. "I mean, like missing commas or the bibliography in the wrong format. Maybe a citation needed here and there. Not an entire freaking country." Darcy groaned and leaned back against the shelf, making the whole thing creak concerningly. "I should go back to poli-sci. I have a feeling an awareness of France is even more important in politics." "I'll fix it," she mumbled. "You've got till Monday, lady, and yes, I'm fully aware Chi Omega is having a party on Saturday night, which means you're going to want to get it done by Friday." Tony sipped his coffee again. "You know I'm going to leave it till Monday morning." "I know, but at least this way I can tell myself I'm trying to teach you a valuable life lesson about procrastination." Darcy suddenly tipped her head to the side. "You know, you're drinking out of both coffees, right? Isn't the other one from Ms. Potts?" Tony looked down at the two cups. "No, they're both for me." "Why not just get a large?" "A large is too small, two larges is too much, two mediums is just right. Don't judge my coffee choices, young lady. I saw you with one of those weird pink unicorn drink things last month." "Yeah, but I'm supposed to be experimenting. I'm 22. Tony cocked an eyebrow and brandished one of the coffees threateningly. "Was that a very thinly veiled commentary on my age?" Darcy smirked. "I would excuse me," came a cool voice from behind them. Tony and Darcy looked up in unison. The extremely unholy love child of protein powder corsets and horny homoerotic Greek statuary was standing at the end of the row scowling at them. "This is a library. Would you mind keeping it down?" Tony blinked twice, shot Darcy a look, getting a, "I don't know, but did you see his arms?" look in return, then turned back to tall, rude, and handsome. "You must be new here, because only someone who hasn't actually tried to find a book in this hellhole would be so generous as to call it a library. I'm pretty sure the entire linguistics section is actually cardboard standees of books. It's called Smith, for Christ's sake." "I don't think there was actually anyone called Smith ever involved. They just wanted it to look like a benefactor had ever had a hand in this cursed knowledge desert. So they picked the first name that came to mind. Have you seen a plaque somewhere thanking Atticus or Tessa or Robert Smith for his contribution?" "I haven't. I'm just saying." Darcy nodded. The man's scowl only deepened. "Look, I'm friends with the head librarian," Tony went on, "and the budget here is a $5 gift card to Buckmart and a package of stale saltine crackers. She'd be the first to admit it's not deserving of a shush." The man bristled. "Regardless of what you may think of it, people are trying to study here, and it's rude to be so loud. Surely you can take your conversation outside." Darcy giggled under her breath and turned to go. "I was just leaving anyway. Bye, Dr. Stark." Tony could feel the man's eyes cutting over to him. "Paper," Tony pointed at her. Monday, after I'm done learning a valuable life lesson about hangover cures. She disappeared around the corner. Tony stared at the man, who was still just standing there, but apparently had nothing else to say. He huffed out a frustrated little noise and turned and walked away. Tony shrugged and took a deep sip from each coffee to keep them balanced. He restacked them, shifted his bag back onto his shoulder, and walked the other way to the far end of the row. He turned back towards Pepper's office and nearly collided with someone else. Good Lord, I've never seen this place so packed. Are they giving out free weed in the foyer? The woman he'd run into took a step back, snapped out a terse apology, and pushed past him at top speed. Tony had never seen her before, and he was sure he'd remember her tightly pulled back hair, all black clothes, and Bluetooth earpiece. She looked like a pre-emotional journey Miranda Priestley's perfect PA had accidentally wandered into the library while looking for a Starbucks. Running into three people at Smith was weird all on its own, but two of them being strangers, this was turning into an odd day. He pushed the door to Pepper's office open with his foot. This is turning into an odd day. Every day that involves you is odd. Yeah, but usually for other people, not me. Tony tried to pull out the spare chair with his hands full of coffee, but it was caught on the cable for Pepper's UV lamp. Pepper plucked one of the cups out of his hand. Thanks. Tony wiggled the chair loose and sat down. He looked up to see Pepper sipping at the coffee. Hey. I deserve it, Pepper said. Tony shrugged. I can't argue with that. What's odd about it? Pepper clicked through a complicated-looking spreadsheet. Well, for one, the entire library is packed with people. It's like a Rolling Stones concert out there. Pepper raised an eyebrow at Tony. I may be slightly exaggerating, but I've never seen so many people in here at once. He leaned back in his chair and petted a leaf on Pepper's spider plant. Tony, don't you have a faculty meeting right about now? No. Tony dug his phone out and checked the time. Yes. Go. We'll get dinner tomorrow night. Tony sighed. I don't want to go. Can't you write me a note? Pepper laughed. She turned away from her computer and leaned her elbow on her desk. Decisions are made by those who show up. An excellent reason to hide here instead. Go away. I have work to do. All right. Tony squeezed her shoulder as he stepped past. Dinner tomorrow. We need to talk about where we're taking Rhodey for his birthday when he gets back from his mission overseas. Thanks for the coffee, she called after him. Tony jogged across the street to Crawley Forum. What he wanted to do tonight was raid the noodle bar in the student lounge and hole up in Houghton until 3 a.m. But first he had to sit through an hour of bureaucracy. It was best to show, though, if only because absent faculty members were the most likely to be volunteered for things. Tony slid into his usual seat at the back of the lecture hall, kicking his feet up onto the chair next to him and letting his sunglasses slip far enough down his nose to conceal the direction of his eyes as he pored over his notes from yesterday's research. He'd been making decent progress on his book project, a study of unconventional military technologies in World War II, until he'd discovered a footnote in an old article about Margaret Carter that had made no sense at all. A reference to the pivotal role that something called Project Rebirth had played in the course of her life. Tony had never encountered the phrase before, and so he'd worked with the research librarian at the Houghton to comb through the electronic records for any documents referencing Margaret Carter that were dated between her time as a codebreaker and the end of the war. He'd narrowed the list down to 4 boxes that seemed most likely to contain more information about Project Rebirth, and with any luck, he'd have time to go through half of that material tonight and identify possible leads. A little knot of people entered from the direction of the science building, and Tony shifted his feet back to the floor to allow Bruce Banner to drop into the seat next to him. Bruce was clutching a load of books under one arm and holding on to a styrofoam plate of precariously piled snacks with the other. When his attempts to shift the books to the table dislodged a cheese cube from the stack, Tony plucked it out of the air and popped it into his mouth. Hey, Bruce muttered, I waited in line for those. Your sacrifice of small talk is appreciated, Tony acknowledged graciously. I would have run the gauntlet myself, but I couldn't risk getting cornered by Mace. He keeps trying to fill that last spot on the budget audit committee, and I am not getting roped into more service right now. This year, I'm saying no to everything that doesn't help get this book written. And I've got a hot date with a manuscript A188.3 at 5 o'clock to prove it. Bold of you to assume the first faculty meeting of the year is going to get out early, Bruce noted with a small smile. I'd ask if you've forgotten the great academic credit for internships filibuster of 2015, but I've seen the way your left eye twitches whenever someone says experiential learning. Well, now you've definitely jinxed us, Tony replied. Everyone knows that when you're inside the faculty meeting, you have to call it the Scottish learning, or it's bad luck. Quick, leave the room and turn around 3 times while spitting over your shoulder. I'll guard your cheese. Bruce smiled and shook his head. But any further reply was headed off by the arrival of a middle-aged man wearing the most nondescript suit Tony had ever seen. The new dean of faculty. Coulson, Tony heard someone whisper, gave a small wave from the front of the hall. Hello, everyone, Coulson greeted them. It's an honor to be joining you here at Stanley College. I look forward to meeting each of you in turn. But as time is precious in the first week of classes, I'm going to call this meeting to order and then give the floor to Dr. Strange, the chair of the Faculty Affairs Committee. He nodded toward Strange, who arranged a stack of papers on the podium with the flourish. Good afternoon, Strange intoned. The first order of business the FAC brings before you is an amendment to the faculty handbook that would allow for online meetings in extenuating circumstances. You will find the proposed language on page 2 of today's agenda. Shocker, Tony muttered, rolling his eyes behind his shades. The proposal in question had been written 8 months ago, brought to 4 successive faculty meetings, and sent back to committee just as many times. But Strange had privately assured him that this time the FAC had whipped all the required votes. All they needed was someone to call the question, and they'd be out of here in time for Tony to top up his coffee before heading to the Houghton. Point of order, a voice interjected, and Tony's head whipped towards the source because he'd be damned if that hadn't sounded exactly like, I believe the general policy is to allow for discussion on all business to do with the faculty handbook, said Hot Hall Monitor. Tony swore under his breath. This could not be happening. What the hell was Judgy Library Guy doing here in Tony's faculty meeting, introducing a point of order? Who the fuck is that? He scribbled furiously on a piece of paper, which he slapped on top of Bruce's notebook, just as the dean provided the requested information. Dr. Grant, Coulson said dryly. I gather you have something to add. Yes, sir, Dr. Grant replied, and Coulson's eyebrows bobbed upward ever so slightly at the honorific. I wanted to draw the faculty's attention to the use of gendered language in Section 2 of the handbook. If you'll turn to the passage in question. Sabbatical replacement in fine arts, Bruce scrawled under Tony's note. Tony's eyes narrowed. He remembered now that Justin Hammer had just started his post-tenure leave. But Tony had been sure the fine arts department had only hired for a 1-year position. He doesn't even go here, Tony whispered theatrically. That's terrible labor politics, Bruce whispered back. And Jane Foster turned around to give them a pointed look. The use of he in this section seems unnecessary and unclear, Grant had continued, and I think we should consider revising these paragraphs to make the language more inclusive. On the far side of the hall, Jasper Sitwell's hand shot up, and Tony let out an involuntary groan, which he hastily stifled with another cube of pilfered cheddar. In my role as faculty clerk, Sitwell began, rising to his feet and settling into a stance that spelled absolute disaster for Tony's hopes of a short meeting. I'd like to lay out 5 considerations. Tony dropped his head into his hands. This is your fault, he muttered to Bruce. But fortunately, the next 50 minutes forced Tony to revise that opinion as Dr. Grant managed to get himself back on the speaker's list a staggering 6 times to raise objections about the rhetorical framing of the Western Cultures class, the lack of diversity requirements for the economics major, and the unequal funding for student political organizations. Each new comment set off an answering volley of bureaucratic considerations from Sitwell, who by this point was vibrating with ill-concealed glee. Tony could feel the will to go on seeping out of him with every passing minute. But the set of Grant's shoulders seemed to indicate that he was just getting started. "Never mind," Tony said to Bruce, jabbing a thumb at Grant as the meeting finally adjourned just before 6 o'clock. "This is definitely his fault." "Yeah, how dare he ask questions about his new workplace?" Bruce raised an eyebrow. "The absolute gall." "Fine, okay. I think I'll just go help him get oriented then," Tony replied. "Show him the ropes a bit." "Tony," Bruce admonished, "be nice." "I'm always nice, Brucey," Tony said, giving his friend a wink over the top of his sunglasses. "I'm a one-man faculty welcoming committee." "That's because you refused to serve on the actual faculty welcoming committee," Bruce pointed out. But Tony was already giving him a jaunty wave as he sauntered down the steps toward the front row of the lecture hall. Grant was still loading his notebooks into a worn leather bag as Tony approached, and Tony found himself idly noticing the flex of Grant's forearms underneath his rolled shirt cuffs. Luckily, his sunglasses concealed the angle of his gaze when Grant looked up to meet his eyes. "Long time no shush," Tony said by way of greeting. "I see you have more than a tourist's interest in library etiquette, so welcome. And don't mind our resident parliamentarian, by the way. Sitwell derives a degree of satisfaction from administrative objections that is frankly NSFW. Grant stared at him blankly. "That's not safe for work if you haven't had any advisees who are extremely online," Tony continued. "Anyway, just thought I'd offer a small word to the wise. It's best not to get Sitwell hot and bothered with points of order, at least not in public. What he really needs is a consenting adult with a matching procedural kink so he can role-play Robert's rules in the privacy of his own home." Grant's stare hardened. "I think I'm capable of forming my own impressions of my colleagues, Dr. Stark, was it?" Grant lingered over the surname, his eyes scrutinizing Tony's features as if to illustrate the distinctly unfavorable impressions he was forming as they spoke. "Can't put anything past you," Tony confirmed, smiling flatly to unclench his jaw. "But feel free to call me Tony. I respond much better to nicknames than I do to public shaming."
"I'll keep that in mind, Dr. Stark," Grant said flatly. "And you might want to keep your own aversion to shaming in mind when you speak with your students. You hold a lot of power over their sense of self-worth."
"Oh, I'm sorry," Tony snapped, tugging the sunglasses off his face so he could look Grant directly in the eyes. "I didn't realize the college had hired you to provide expert training in academic advising. That seems like a lot of work on top of your extracurricular volume policing, not to mention what appears to be a full-time position in the Department of Sisyphean Policy Battles. Hope they offered you a better life insurance policy than the rest of us, if today's little performance is any indication of how many time-consuming, untenable hills you're planning to die on." Grant's brow furrowed, and he shoved the last notebook into his bag with so much force that the leather creaked ominously.
"Well, unfortunately for you, I happen to have a lot of experience in that area," he replied finally, a new, sour note creeping into his voice. "And you're right. The benefits package never quite covers the costs." With that, he hoisted the strap of his bag over one shoulder and strode out of the lecture hall, leaving Tony staring after him in annoyance. How had Dr. Nothing Tastes as Good as Self-Righteousness Feels managed to steal his cue for a dramatic exit again? It was an infuriating tendency, Tony reflected, one that was only partially counterbalanced by the not entirely displeasing spectacle presented by his retreating ass. Jeffrey Mace's voice echoed down the hallway, reminding Tony that he had lingered in the lecture hall for a dangerously long period of time. Taking a long drag from his now cold coffee cup to fortify himself, he made a beeline for the exit and headed for the faculty parking lot before he could be forced to come up with another polite version of, "Thank you for thinking of me, but I'd rather be slowly pressed to death with the weight of my own lecture notes." The late end to the meeting meant even more crosstown traffic. and by the time Tony made it to the Houghton, he only had time to call up one box from Special Collections. He got ready at one of the long tables while he waited for the materials, running his hand through his hair to stop himself from drumming his pen against the table. Goddamn library etiquette. When the box arrived, Tony dove into its contents immediately, eyes scanning rapidly across each item in search of any references to Carter or Rebirth. Finally, he came across a clear plastic sleeve containing a collection of loose sheets of paper. The page that was visible at the top of the pile contained two short paragraphs of handwritten notes, the second of which mentioned a reunion with Peggy Carter. Tony gently shuffled the papers out of their protective sleeve, laying them flat on the table so he could snap a photo of each one with his phone. When he got to the third sheet in the pile, he came across more names to add to his notes. Abraham Erskine, who appeared to be the author of the notes. Chester Phillips, whose name Tony recognized as belonging to a colonel who had been briefly attached to Camp Lehigh. A U.S. senator named Craig Brandt, and a couple of private soldiers by the names of Gilmore Hodge and Stephen Rogers. Tony flipped to the next page and finally saw the magic words. Project Rebirth appeared in the neat, tightly packed letters of Erskine's script right there in the final line. Tony could feel a surge of adrenaline hit his system, his hand wavering just slightly as he photographed the page. But when he turned the sheet over to follow the trail onto the next paragraph, all that he found was wall-to-wall black boxes. Hardly a word had been left unredacted, leaving an inscrutable arrangement of articles, pronouns, and repeated surnames, Phillips and Hodge, followed by a blank, but I, followed by another blank, and then Rogers, followed by the longest blank yet. Fuck. This book was going to be the death of him. Chapter 2. I think you're being a little hard on him, Tony, Bruce suggested. The two of them were observing their monthly ritual of hitting the local dive bar after a lecture by a visiting speaker. In any previous semester, the talk they'd just attended, an analysis of the figure of extinction in the poetry of Alfred Lord Tennyson, would probably have led to the kind of meandering debate that had first brought Bruce and Tony together over a pitcher of margaritas and a plate of oversalted nachos during their new faculty orientation. They'd settle into a booth by the door and wander toward a topic about which they both knew just enough to have strong, unfalsifiable opinions. How wrong Charles Lyell was about gradualism, for example, or how deeply to read into the homoeroticism of In Memoriam A.H.H. But today, as he walked into the auditorium of Colan Hall to learn about Victorian eco-poetics, Tony had found himself unable to concentrate on anything other than Dr. Grant's irritatingly fastidious note-taking three rows in front of him. The man is so full of righteous causes, they're bursting through his shirt seams, Tony insisted, which would be annoying enough. Where does he get off emerging from grad school so chiseled and clear-sighted, instead of slouching out under the weight of 100 overdue library books and half a decade of repressed shame like the rest of us? But he also seems determined to take the whole faculty down with him. If this is about the reply all incident, I think it's possible he made an honest mistake. Nope. Nuh-uh, no way, Brucey. This was not an oops, I just sent everyone on the admissions committee a photo of my dog. He CC'd the alumni list, sir, to suggest that the lack of therapists in student services was willful negligence. I could hear the president screaming about sole fiduciary responsibility from my office. So he wants to be active in the institution, Bruce allowed. Last week at the faculty mixer, he suggested we take a look at curriculum review, Bruce. Curriculum review! You know, the reason the classics department isn't allowed to meet without a mediator? These are not the actions of a man of peace. You don't call for curriculum review in the year of our accelerating institutional austerity, 2018, unless you want to see blood on the walls. He's early career, Tony, Bruce pointed out. You remember what we were like when we got hired, job market behind us, plenty of postdoc work still in the pipeline. No one had ever invited us to a workshop on models for assessing assessment models. And so we'd never known true despair. A lot of things looked different then. But that's my point, Tony retorted. Grant is brand new. I bet the ink is barely dry on his final transcripts. And yet he comes charging into every meeting like he knows exactly what's wrong with the college. No way you make yourself that vulnerable as a VAP unless you've got an angle. He paused, jabbing a cardboard coaster at Bruce for dramatic effect. I think he's trying to make a move to get Hammer's job permanently. You can't stand Hammer, Bruce pointed out. Last year at a faculty meeting, you told him he wouldn't recognize chiaroscuro if someone taped a strobe light to his head. Exactly, Tony agreed. So clearly I'm being extremely disinterested about this. Clearly, Bruce murmured, taking a slow sip of his IPA and regarding Tony carefully. And I'm sure this fixation on an energetic new colleague has nothing whatsoever to do with the fact that you've pushed back your research talk three times this month. Tony picked at the corner of his coaster while he considered his response. There was no point pretending he wasn't panicking, he supposed, since he'd pulled the trigger on the third postponement just yesterday, with a flimsy excuse about needing to attend to new developments in his father's estate. He'd bought himself 3 more weeks, enough time either to pull together 40 minutes of new material or else cobble together a talk based on old research and watch Tyler Hayward from the Promotion and Tenure Committee shake his head in faux regret from the first row. I really did have to deal with my dad's shit, he said finally. Turns out he'd been keeping another little hoarder's stash at the house of an old army buddy who finally kicked the bucket, and I had to scramble to find a storage unit until I can weed through yet another personal archive of Howard Stark's unappreciated glory days. But the real problem is that I've hit a wall with my chapter on Peggy Carter and the SSR. I thought I might be getting somewhere with that German doctor's notes, but every time I find a document with any combination of Carter, Rebirth, and Erskine, the next page looks like found poetry. I've spent weeks just staring into a black sea of censor bars. Bruce had been nodding along slowly as Tony spoke, and now he leaned forward to rest his forearms on the table between them. Okay, I'm going to ask the really obvious question here, he began. What if this obscure footnote has remained an obscure footnote because there's actually no there? Tony jumped in. What if I blow my chances of getting this book under contract before I go up for a full professor by obsessing about a tiny detail that may turn out to be nothing more than a heavily redacted military boondoggle? What if this time next year Hayward is climbing over my prone body on the way to his new office as associate dean, and I have only these loose pages of inconclusive notes and a middle-aged hamster with obsessive-compulsive tendencies to comfort me as I slide slowly into ever-increasing professional obscurity. Good guesses, Bruce responded with a small smile, but I was going to ask whether you'd considered inventing time travel. Only about a dozen times a day during my final year of grad school, Tony responded, though to be fair, that was more of an escape route than a research plan. I know how much you've invested in this project, Tony, Bruce said gently, but it's just like the dissertation. At some point, you have to stop inventing new reasons that it's not done and just call it. Eventually, it's as good as it's going to get. God, I know, Tony replied, running his hands through his hair with a grimace. I know. Every rational part of me says that I should put a pin in Rebirth and move on. But I can't shake the feeling that there's something here. You know, when you wake up in the middle of the night, halfway through writing the next paragraph, because even in your sleep, your brain keeps working the problem. I'm dreaming about these files, Bruce. And you're sure you're not confusing intuition with avoidance behavior? Bruce pressed. Brucey Bear, I love you. And the faith in me implied by that question warms the cockles of my poor, caffeine-abused heart. But if I could tell the difference between those two things, I promise you that both my career and my kitchen counters would look very different right now. One week later, Tony's kitchen counters were still covered in cryptic post-it notes, an assortment of bakery boxes, and the unused crock pot that Pepper had made him buy the month before. Something about a last-ditch attempt to keep him from dying of the kind of lifestyle diseases that used to kill malnourished 18th-century cabin boys. His research, however, was finally showing signs of clearing up. The light peeked through the clouds in an unexpected place. The Google alert that Tony had set up for Margaret Carter returned a result from Brooklyn Community College. The accompanying article explained that the college was naming a new wing of their library in Carter's honor, in gratitude for her long-standing support and a generous donation that the Carter estate had made after her passing in 2016. Tony tapped the end of a pen against his cheek rapidly as he reread the page. He knew Carter had briefly worked at the SSR office in Brooklyn, but he'd never heard of any connections to the community college. He shoved his rolling chair backward across his home office, ignoring the faint crackle of protest from the stray, ungraded paper he ran over on the way, and grabbed his dog-eared copy of Peggy Carter's only biography, the somewhat regrettably titled Plant Yourself Like a Tree, the Peggy Carter story. He flipped back to the index and ran his index finger through the B's until it rested on the blank space between brooch key and brother Michael. Right, family. Tony cut sideways across the page in search of Carter and started running through the names of Peggy's close relatives, popping each one into Google to check for any time spent at Brooklyn Community College. Brother Michael, no. Husband Daniel, no. Great niece Sharon, no. Daughter Anna, no. Son Stephen. Tony's finger hovered over the final name. Even as Google spit back another negative, Stephen Carter had gone to Dartmouth, Tony found himself scrolling through result after result, looking for something that might explain the niggling feeling at the back of his brain. Stephen was a common enough name. There was no particular reason to suspect a connection between Peggy Carter's former rugby captain's son and the private Stephen Rogers whose name had popped up in Erskine's notes. Still, Tony drew a circle around Carter Stephen in his book and turned his attention back to the press release. It was sparse on detail, but it did contain a small note at the bottom enumerating some of the specific terms of Peggy Carter's generosity, a needs-based scholarship in the art department, three artist sketches for the college's art museum, and a small collection of archival materials for the library. Bingo, Tony informed Dummy, his long-suffering hamster, who poked his nose out of a messy pile of fluff, blinked blearily, then retreated when no sunflower seeds were forthcoming. Tony navigated his way to the web pages for both the museum and the library to see if he could find any clues about what might have been included in the Carter collections. But none of the materials seemed to be digitized, and none of the library guides flagged World War II as an area of interest. He lunged to the side to grab his phone from where he'd left it, marking his progress through a stack of midterms. He plugged in the number listed at the bottom of the BCC webpage and leaned back in his chair, drumming absently on the edge of his desk as the phone rang. "Thank you for calling the Brooklyn Community College Library," an automated voice said finally. "Our normal hours of operation are Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., and Saturday through Sunday, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. "Shit," Tony said, pressing his fingers against his temple in a concerted effort to remember what day it was. "Saturday, 4 p.m. "Shit," he sighed again, ending the call before the tone could prompt him to leave a message. He'd have to try again the next morning, no point speculating when fewer than 24 hours stood between him and knowing whether some key to his professional salvation was or wasn't sitting in the basement of an aging Gothic library in Brooklyn. The sensible thing to do would be to put it out of his mind and get back to the midterms he'd promised his American History 2 students last Friday. but now his nerves were crawling with the anticipation of an archival find, and the thought of reading through sophomore attempts to describe the Teapot Dome scandal felt like death by a thousand accidental substitutions of Hoover for Harding. He was too keyed up to lesson plan. Last year's seminar discussion of the top five historical rioting strategies and how to apply them today had taught him the hard way that adrenaline and course prep were a dangerous mixture. The only option left was to hit something. Tony hadn't been to the gym in an embarrassingly long time. But when everything else failed, sometimes that shot of endorphins would ease him into an emotional state approximating what Bruce assured him other people experienced as patience. If it didn't, at least the day wouldn't be a complete waste. Though considering how many Cheetos he'd already eaten today, it might be a necessity. He dropped the last neon orange puff in Dummy's cage for him to find when he deigned to reappear later and grabbed his gym bag. The gym was quiet this time of day. Only three other guys there. It was precisely why Tony used the YMCA across from campus instead of the student center gym. There were times when it was fine running into your students, and times when it definitely wasn't. All of Tony's top three were from wretched experience, when sweating profusely, when so drunk he started spouting Wilfred Owen, and the day parents came to empty the dorms and saw their kids' grades for the first time. But the YMCA was quiet, as long as he didn't come right before or after normal working hours, and it had a hot tub and a faculty discount. There was an older guy trotting steadily on a treadmill, a teenager piling weights back on the rack, and an astonishingly stunning ass thrust up towards Tony in a steady and flexy downward dog. He resisted the urge to whistle. Tony took the long way around to the locker rooms, checking out the legs attached to the ass as he walked by. Shorts just short enough to be a teasing invitation revealed thighs that could crush a watermelon and calves that could make a drunk man cry. Not that Tony had ever cried over calves while drunk, but he'd never been wasted around these before. If the gym weren't an extremely inappropriate place to ask someone out, Tony would have seen if he could get his runner's high in another way today. He slipped into the locker room and changed. He grabbed his wraps in case he decided to box, but with his focus all over the place, the treadmill seemed like a better idea. The gorgeous ass was seated on the chest press machine, and Tony walked past so he could admire the pecs and abs he was sure went with legs like those. But when he rounded the equipment and came face to face with the man, it pushed a curse out of him. Oh, for fuck's sake. Dr. Grant stilled, startled, then frowned at Tony. Dr. Stark. He folded his hands in his lap. Good afternoon. Normally takes new faculty at least 2 months to be chased out of the student center gym by grade change requests. Dr. Grant's expression flickered, like he was trying to figure out if Tony was making fun of him or not. I'm used to the YMCA. Brooklyn, right? Tony asked, suddenly catching a hint of an accent. Dr. Grant frowned. I've been all over, he said, suddenly sounding like a perfectly bland Midwestern news anchor. Right. Well, right now you're being all over my favorite chest press machine. Are you done? Oh. Dr. Grant stood and Tony instantly felt bad. He'd been expecting him to snap back, not concede. I'll just spray it down for you. He cleaned the seat, then stepped back a bit, still hovering, and Tony had no choice but to adjust the weight down a truly embarrassing number of notches and take a seat. Dr. Grant didn't move. Tony stared at him. I have that honor student of yours, Ms. Lewis, in one of my classes, Dr. Grant said slightly awkwardly. Tony took the handles and breathed out as he pressed away from him. He instantly wished he'd taken it down a few more pounds. Yeah, I think every faculty member at the entire college has Darcy in one of their classes. She's brilliant, but focused isn't a word I'd use to describe her. She's very funny. Dr. Grant still wasn't leaving. Deadpan. Tony was forced to do another chest press, resisting the urge to whimper as he eased back down again. Yep, she reminds me of me at that age. at most other ages, except I'm a better rapper. You should see me do Rap God. A small smile flickered at the corner of Dr. Grant's lips, and Tony wondered how many co-eds he'd gone through in grad school. The legs were still presenting a serious problem. She spoke very highly of you. Tony gave up on pretending to do chest presses. You talked about me? Dr. Grant's cheeks flushed slightly. I thought you two were arguing in the library earlier, and I wanted to make sure she was okay. She assured me she came out the victor. Tony scoffed. Hardly. That paper was a train wreck, and I highly doubt she can bring it up past Fender Bender by Monday. She said you were a bit of a dick, but in what seemed like the nicest way possible. Tony raised an eyebrow. Yep, that's Darcy, all right. Well, anyway, Dr. Grant waved vaguely. They stared at each other for a moment. Dr. Grant gestured at the chest press machine. Need a spot? He asked, too sweetly. Tony glared. Any forgiveness he'd been feeling towards Dr. Grant immediately evaporated. Doing just fine on my own, actually. I wouldn't want to disrupt what must be a very carefully crafted workout. He indicated Dr. Grant's carefully crafted calves. Thank you, though. All right. Well, if you want any advice on how to use any of the machines, I'm happy to help. Tony gritted his teeth together hard enough that he felt his dentist wince from 14 blocks over. Thanks. Dr. Grant waved and walked off towards the leg curls. Tony stayed on the chest press machine just long enough that he could claim a set, then cleaned it off and made a beeline for a treadmill. He put his headphones in, started his Best of Black Sabbath playlist, and started to jog. You're going to call the library tomorrow, he told himself. You're going to see those special collections, and there's going to be something there that makes the whole picture come together. He found a nice rhythm, and his breathing started to even out. You got this. You are calm and sane and stable and an excellent professor who is about to finish an excellent book. He was going to figure this out. But Tony was also pretty sure that if he ran into Dr. Grant one more goddamn time this week, he was going to lose it. Chapter 3. In the end, Tony was too impatient to wait long enough to call the library back. He'd hoped that the rare workout at the gym would set him up for an equally rare 8 hours of sleep. But despite what was shaping up to be a truly epic case of delayed onset muscle soreness, rest had refused to come. The final straw came at 6 a.m. when Tony woke up in a cold sweat from a recurring nightmare that the college was making him repeat his dissertation defense. Except this time, one of his committee members had been replaced by Dr. Grant, clad in a pair of tweed shorts that left even less to the imagination than his workout apparel. After lying awake for a half hour staring at the ceiling in a state of frustration, it was only 50% sexual, 65% at the absolute most. Tony had said fuck it and decided to drive to Brooklyn. Fuck it, he repeated. As he walked up to the glass doors of the college library, he may have just dropped a cool $42 on 3 hours of parking, but he was going to walk out of this with something to put on the page. Maybe there would be some file or note that mentioned rebirth here, and maybe there wouldn't. But either way, he'd break more fresh ground than he could by poring over his notes for the 50th time in the hopes that a new word would suddenly slip out from behind the censor bars. Once inside the stone building, Tony headed straight for the reference desk, which was being staffed by a man who looked like he may have borne personal witness to the signing of the Declaration of Independence. A placard sitting next to a steaming mug of tea announced the man as Arnie Roth, research librarian. Can I help you? He asked as Tony approached the desk. I'm betting 2 tanks of gas and a 3-point hit on the returns work in a timely manner portion of my student evals that the answer to that is yes, Tony responded. Tony Stark, I'm sorry I didn't call ahead. I'm a professor of history at Stanley College, and I'm hoping I can take a look at the special collections donated by Margaret Carter. Ah, yes, Arnie remarked, a smile spreading across his face. I was hoping someone would see her name in the papers and come asking. He made his way out from behind the desk and began to move toward the back of the building, in a slow but determined totter, waving Tony along with one hand. I never got the sense that it bothered Agent Carter too much that so few people came to see the papers, he continued. But for myself, I would have liked them to get a bit more air. You know what's in them, Tony said, his nerves jittery with the effort of matching his pace to the speed of Arnie's deliberate crawl. I know who is in them, Arnie corrected. Met him right behind this building, as a matter of fact. Had to help him out of a dumpster after he confronted some schmuck trying to feel up his date. He walked through the door to the reading room and held it open for Tony. I'm sorry, who are we talking about? Tony asked. Steve Rogers, Arnie replied in a matter-of-fact tone, and Tony tripped over his own feet on the way into the room. The soldier? Tony demanded. He was a private in the U.S. Army? Not when I knew him, Arnie retorted, waving his hand again to indicate Tony should take a seat. When I knew him, he was taking night classes in life drawing and getting his scrawny ass handed to him behind every brownstone in the borough. The skinniest, scrappiest son of a bitch I've ever seen. He disappeared momentarily behind a row of shelves, and Tony pulled back a chair from the long wooden table in the middle of the room. He perched on the edge of the seat and fished out his phone and notebooks, trying to fit Arnie's revelations into the framework of what he knew about Peggy Carter. Maybe Rogers had played a larger role in Project Rebirth than Tony had thought, which might explain how Carter had come into possession of his records. But why would she give his files to his community college with so little fanfare? And why hadn't Tony come across any other mentions of Rogers' name in the studies of her career? Arnie returned from the stacks with a single slim box in his hands. He set it on the table in front of Tony with elaborate care, fussing with its position a few times before he finally pulled away. I made them mention the donations in the announcement because I hoped someone would come, he reiterated. I watched Rogers out stubborn asthma attacks, scarlet fever, and half the assholes east of Manhattan, and no one was ever able to tell me why everything that's left of him can fit in this box. He nodded at Tony as if in shared understanding. You'll find out what happened to him. I'll do my best, Tony replied, finding himself at a loss for what to do with the look of assurance in the old man's eyes. Arnie gave him a final nod and then tottered back toward the door. Tony brushed a hand across the lid of the box. A minute ago, he'd been eager to start scouring the container for anything that could be of use to him. But after Arnie's speech, he felt strangely hesitant to break the seal, to be the first person in years to witness the remnants of Roger's life, one of many chewed up by the weapons Tony spent his days studying from afar. I'll do my best, Tony repeated, feeling only a little foolish as he lifted the lid and peered inside. What he found was not an abundance of matter. The sheets of paper, many yellowed with age, didn't even fill the box to the brim. At the top of the stack was an enlisted reserves ID card, which gave Rogers' date of enlistment as July 1943, for the duration of the war plus 6 months. He joined the reserves at 26 years old, and according to the second half of the card, he'd had blonde hair, blue eyes, a fair complexion, and stood just 5'4" tall. Tony supposed that last fact explained some of the ass-kickings. Next came an order to report for duty at Camp Lehigh, signed by Colonel Chester Phillips, a confirmation at least of the connection suggested by Erskine's notes. Notes from a doctor's exam, featuring a truly stunning number of conditions that would have disqualified most enlistees from service. A ration card with the regiment left blank and the hash marks indicating regular supplies had been collected for only half the period. The missing week suggested that Rogers had either tried to go cold turkey on sweets or had spent substantial time behind enemy lines in September, and a transcript of an order for troop movement, which indicated that Rogers had left for London in September 1943 in the company of James Morita, James Montgomery Falsworth, Gabe Jones, Jacques Dernier, Timothy Aloysius Cadwallader Dugan, and James Buchanan Barnes. One of those names, at least, Tony knew he had come across in Carter's biography, though Dugan had been going by Dum Dun by then. Tony lingered longer over the next sheet, a light pencil sketch of a train thundering through a mountain pass. The lines were soft but assured, at least to Tony's amateur eyes, and the cheap quality of the paper somehow made the scene feel more moving. A series of drawings followed, some of landscapes and a few of what appeared to be fellow soldiers. And Tony wondered, what had made an attentive, chronically ill artist want to go from getting beat up in Brooklyn to getting thrown on barbed wire at the front? He'd expected to find an individual deceased personnel file at the bottom of the box, or perhaps a telegram of condolence addressed to a parent or sibling. But the last sheet of the stack was an unfinished letter that appeared to have been written by Rogers himself. "Dear Mrs. Barnes," it read, "I can't even find the words to tell you how sorry I am." Then there was a dark spot and a small tear in the page, as if the pencil had pressed too hard on the next words. The remaining paper was blank, except for a lonely sign-off. "More love than I can say. Steve Rogers." Tony drummed his fingers thoughtfully against the table as he pulled up the online veterans' records at the National Archives. But while a quick check of the honored list of dead and missing soldiers yielded one result for James B. Barnes, the search engine came up empty on Stephen G. Rogers. Struck by a sudden suspicion, Tony switched over to enlistment and draft records and plugged in Rogers' name and date of birth. "Well, shit," he muttered out loud, staring back and forth between Rogers' ID card and the utterly blank search results. "What the fuck?" What Carter had left behind in her donation was hardly a mountain of evidence, but it was surely enough to suggest that Steve Rogers had existed. He had enlisted in the Army. He had served overseas, and somehow he had been erased from official records. It felt like the surest sign yet that Project Rebirth was something big, something that could change the whole narrative of his book. It also felt like another goddamn dead end. By the time Tony made it back to campus, it was in the awkward period between lunch and dinner, and Tony's stomach was in the middle of an argument between probably never actually met a poultry chicken nuggets he'd picked up when he stopped for gas and about 14 liters of coffee. Deciding that adding sugar was the only way to make it a fair fight, he shouldered his bag and made his way to the Byrne dining hall. May Parker always had a piece of whatever the Sunday dessert was, if it was good, in case Tony stopped by, and he'd heard a rumor today was lemon meringue. The cafeteria was pretty quiet, just a light smattering of students mixing bowls of every kind of cereal from the all-day breakfast counter to get them through a binge study session. There were a few people in line, though, so Tony pulled in at the end and dug his phone out. "Dr. Stark!" Tony resisted the urge to look right into the camera like he was on The Office, turned to find one of his puppy-esque honor students bouncing eagerly at his side. This particular student happened to be the nephew of the chef who supplied his pie, so he pushed back his anger and turned on the charm. "Well, if it isn't Mr. Parker, how's your primary source analysis coming along?" "Oh, I finished that on Tuesday." "You're not going to forget the part where you actually turn it in this time, are you?" "Definitely not." Parker's eyes went wide and pleading, looking like a combination between an iPhone emoji and Puss in Boots. Tony expected violin music to start swelling any minute. "What do you want?" he asked cautiously. "Okay, so you know my girlfriend, MJ?" "Mm-hmm." "So she's in the theater program, and I'm part of the audiovisual club, And so they asked me to do the light design for this semester's showcase performance, because the drama department doesn't have a light design course. Peter paused, considering that for a moment. Or set design. Or, like most things. It's adorable that it's only dawning on you now that this school has a fine arts budget of an amateur magic show. Anyway, the show is next Thursday through Sunday, and everyone volunteered to sell a certain number of tickets, and I was wondering if you wanted to go. Tony gritted his teeth and tried to make it look like a smile. Sure, why not? Put me down for two. He'd make Rhodey come with him if he was in town. It'd be payback for the time Rhodey had made Tony sit through an entire documentary on model plane engineers. Oh, thank you, Dr. Stark. Peter rummaged in his bag and came up with a folded wad of papers. He unfolded them and scribbled Dr. Stark into a pre-printed chart. Then he added two beside it. Tony caught a glimpse of what was written on the top of the page and blanched. God. He wasn't sure he could sit through 2 hours of Stanley College's best and brightest drama students performing Cats. Maybe he could trick Pepper and Rhodey into both coming, and then just forget to turn up himself. Thank you, Parker called again, and then he was off, heading towards the back door to the kitchen. Parker's Aunt May worked 2 afternoons a week in the cafeteria to help pay for Parker's tuition, and on Sundays, Peter bussed as well to thank her. He was a brilliant kid, and Tony suffered the guilty reminder that he still had a half-finished nomination for the Exemplary Leadership Award to submit for him. Parker deserved it. Tony realized the line had moved on without him, so he scurried up to the window. He caught sight of a familiar mess of brown hair and leaned on the counter. My darling May, how are you this fine Sunday afternoon? May startled around. Tony, well, well, well. Didn't expect to see you today. Why not? I heard it was lemon meringue day. Don't tell me I skipped a week by accident again and it's cherry cobbler. No. It's lemon. It's just kind of late and, well... May adopted a pout that was eerily similar to her nephew's. I'd kind of given up on seeing you. Me? Give up on my May time? Not in a million years. Tony flashed her his most charming smile. You know I come for you and not the pie, my dear. Well, that's good, because she winced. I kind of gave away your slice. What? Tony's jaw dropped. I'm cut to the quick. How could you? It's late. I didn't think you were coming. Plus, I gave it to someone who really deserved it, I promise. She fluttered her eyelashes. Tony sighed. Fine, I guess I forgive you. Which lucky bastard absconded with my pie? May's cheeks pinked. Do you know the new art professor, Dr. Grant? Tony's teeth clenched so hard they ached. We've met. Well, May leaned forward conspiratorially. I was cleaning up around the fountain drinks, and I had a whole tray of glasses. I tripped over a chair leg that was stuck out, and the whole thing went up in the air. I didn't even know he was behind me, but he caught the whole damn tray, Tony. It was amazing. Not a single glass broken. Incredible, Tony said flatly, imagining the tart zing of the lemon curd that was currently blessing Dr. Grant's tongue instead of his own. You know, he was mentioning how much he liked the live music at the new brewery. So I think you two would really get along, she winked. Maybe even get along. Stop trying to get me a date, May. You know you're the only one for me. She laughed. Do you want a cookie? Duh. Tony took his double chocolate macadamia back out towards the side door, but a large table filled with students caught his eye, and he did a double take when he realized who was leading the study group. Of course, Dr. Man of the People Grant ate lunch with his students and offered crit on their coursework. Tony couldn't help himself. How is the pie? Dr. Grant turned bright, innocent eyes on Tony. Pardon? I hear you earn pie in exchange for a positively ballet-like drinking glass save. Dr. Grant seemed oddly embarrassed by it. Ms. Parker is very kind. Tony hiked his bag higher on his shoulder. Yeah, I don't think you're exactly her type, he muttered. Flash Thompson apparently heard because he rolled his eyes. Oh my God, just get a room already, he said, sotto voce, and a few students giggled. Actually, you can have this one, Tony replied, and my pie, and my weight machines, and probably all my summer funding or something. He turned away and stalked off towards the double doors that led outside. The weather had turned bitterly cold, and as soon as the frigid air hit him, Tony shivered. Hey! Tony turned to see Dr. Grant storming out of the cafeteria after him. He was so tired and frustrated that he snapped out, What? Do you want my shoes and my favorite cereal spoon, too? Grant frowned. What is your problem with me? Look, this college may be small, but it's not that small, you know. And yet everywhere I turn, there you are, biceps and all, swanning around and charming everyone and adding a third and fourth circle of hell to faculty meetings. Dr. Grant looked at his own arms as if trying to figure out the connection that his biceps had to do with it. I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm just trying to be the best teacher I can be. Well, maybe you can be the best teacher you can be somewhere other than my gym. This is about the YMCA? Tony huffed. He was grumpy and hungry, sore from too many hours in the car, and a new headache was blooming behind his eyes. You know what? Fuck it. Maybe if we continue on this way, you'll take my grading, too. Lord knows I'd need it. He made a vague gesture and stomped off through the icy air. What are you? Grant half shouted, cutting himself off with a frustrated grunt. Tony was relieved when he heard the cafeteria doors close behind him again. Grant could go back to charming the entire student body and faculty with his stupid hair and his aw shucks charm. He was probably planning to spend the evening helping Parker paint cartoon trash cans on plywood for the production of Cats, right before he went downtown and helped little old ladies cross the street. Tony fumed pointlessly all the way home. He took a shower and put on his cozy robe, then threw a microwave meal in. He put Dummy in his robe pocket with a handful of grapes to keep him busy and slumped down at his desk, his research spread out in front of him. He dug his photocopies from BCC out of his bag and added them to the haphazard pile. The mushy pasta and vague cream sauce from his packet meal didn't satisfy as he dug his way through it, so he stole one of Dummy's grapes. This is all shit, he told the hamster who emerged from his pocket, cheeks fit to bursting, and eyed him up, and I have to stand in front of everyone in 2 weeks and pretend it's not shit. Dummy's nose wiggled, whiskers going mad. Oh, God, and Dr. Grant is going to be there because that asshole would never miss a chance to offer a colleague constructive criticism, I'm sure, Tony groaned and tipped face down on his desk. Unless Dr. Grant wouldn't be there. Tony hadn't actually booked the library space yet, so he had some leeway. Maybe he could find a time when Dr. Grant had class or professional development or was on vacation. Then, even though he had nothing at all of substance to present, he wouldn't be embarrassing himself in front of his arch nemesis, at the very least. Tony dug his laptop out of his bag and started it up. Dummy ran up and down his sleeves while Tony navigated to the faculty calendar. He scrolled through, but apparently Dr. Grant knew enough about digital security to have unclicked the Merge My Calendars button when he set up his faculty account, unlike about 90% of the rest of the staff. Tony huffed with frustration. He tapped his fingers idly on the keys. No one would know if he just peeked. His misspent youth had come in handy sometimes, right? And unlike hacking his dad's email at 13 to try to delete the confirmation emails sent by some rather questionable websites he may have tried to pretend to be 18 to sign up for, this would be his stealth mission. Pop in, find out when Dr. Grant would be too busy to attend Tony's talk, pop out. He shoved in another forkful of the pasta and grimaced. Yeah, he needed a win tonight. He popped in. As soon as Dr. Grant's calendar came up, Tony frowned. That's weird. He started clicking through each day. Grant's schedule was littered with unexplained absences. He'd canceled multiple classes and rescheduled his office hours on several of the days he didn't teach. He was making Tony look positively dutiful in comparison. A little bit of petty delight flushed through Tony, and he ate the rest of his pasta in celebration. "Looks like Professor Perfect isn't so faultless after all," Tony mused. "Wonder if the new dean has noticed one of his recent hires as a truant, Tricia." How was Grant going to make any of his own research deadlines at this rate? Exhaustion slammed sideways into Tony like a Mack truck, so he saved a screenshot of Dr. Grant's next month so he could book the library and logged out. "We deserve ice cream," he told Dummy, pushing out of his chair. He took Dummy's silence for agreement. Chapter 4. 1 week after the infamous lemon curd incident, Tony knocked on the doorframe to the dean's office, fresh ammunition in hand. "Phil, you free?" Dr. Coulson looked up from his papers and managed to visibly sigh without moving or exhaling. "For you? Never." "Good." Tony slipped inside and took the chair opposite him. "So how are you settling in, Phil? Enjoying the dean's life? I don't personally know what that's like. You'll be shocked to learn that no one's ever considered me for an administrative role, but I imagine it involves a lot of scheduling meetings that could have been emails and politely denying funding requests." Coulson stared at him evenly for a moment. "Was that an attempt to butter me up, Stark?" he asked. "Because if so, I would estimate that your chances of getting on my good side are going to be inversely correlated to the amount of time you spend in my office." "Tough, but fair," Tony allowed. "And as a token of my appreciation for your deanly candor, I'll get right to it. I sit before you today to share a little friendly concern about Dr. Grant." "Dr. Grant," Coulson repeated. His tone is flat and featureless as the cut of his suit. "I hear very good things." "Yes, yes, he's wonderfully earnest. And he catches all kinds of fragile dinnerware while treating his advisees to unassailably populous brands of coffee. And we're all very lucky, I'm sure. The thing is, though, Phil, I was looking at the meeting calendar for the Fine Arts Department, and I couldn't help but notice that Dr. Grant has canceled 5 classes already this semester. And out of a concern for the value of our students' education and for the professional development of an esteemed junior colleague..." "I'm going to stop you right there," Coulson interrupted. And it really was remarkable how he managed to cut off all possibility of future speech without changing either his volume or his position. "Because I have to ask first what earthly explanation you might offer for having hacked into another department's calendar to look at Dr. Grant's teaching schedule in the first place." "That's none of your business," Tony responded automatically, sitting back in his chair and folding his arms across his chest. "You're not the boss of me." Coulson raised his eyebrows. "I am literally the boss of you," he pointed out. "You know that's how this arrangement works, right? And that brings me to my second point, which is that Dr. Grant is here in a visiting position and thus lacks the protection of tenure. So before we proceed any further with this conversation, you might want to reflect on what steps you hope I'll take with the information you've acquired." Tony bit the inside of his cheek, feeling a curl of something like shame settling in his stomach. "We don't know each other very well, Dr. Stark," Coulson continued, "but I don't judge you to be the kind of man who tells tales about his colleagues out of school. So I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that you might have more pressing things on your mind than your colleagues' classroom performance. Like, I don't know, just to introduce an example chosen entirely at random, finishing the research talk you're scheduled to give around this time next week. You know, it usually takes people longer than this to grow suspicious of my ability to meet deadlines," Tony remarked. Coulson's lips compressed marginally. "Does it?" he asked mildly. "No, not really," Tony admitted. "You're about on pace, actually." "Well, that's a relief," Coulson replied. "Dr. Grant is great with the students," Tony offered suddenly, leaning forward to fiddle with the angle of a lamp on Coulson's desk. "Irritatingly great, actually. He shows up to all their lacrosse games and glee club performances. It's embarrassing." If it was possible for Coulson's face to soften, it softened, and he gave Tony one more considering look before straightening the stack of papers in front of him with a deft sweep of one hand. "Thanks for the tip," he acknowledged. "And now, as delightful as this little chat has been, I still have a lot of funding requests to politely deny. So if that's all you had for me, I'm going to advise that you stop touching my lamp and start working on your talk. Anywhere, literally anywhere, but here." Tony rose from his chair, giving Coulson a mock salute. He was almost to the door before Coulson called out a final time. "Oh, and Tony, if you hear any more whispering about Dr. Grant's schedule, you can feel free to come straight back to me. I take a personal interest in the careers of our more vulnerable faculty members." Thank you all for coming this evening. Tony tapped a few times at the edge of the lectern, waiting for a gradual quiet to fall over the fourth floor of the library, where a group of colleagues and a few overeager students had gathered for his much postponed talk. "I'm sure most of you are here for the free wine or the extra credit, so I'll make this as short and sweet as possible." A polite smattering of laughter followed, and Tony flashed a tight smile, only to have it stretch a notch tighter when he saw Dr. Grant slipping into an open chair near the back. So much for Tony's hopes that Grant would be too busy getting ready for a student's gallery opening to attend the talk. Not that anything about the past few months had suggested Tony would catch a break. He cleared his throat, smoothing the front of his notes unnecessarily. He could do this. He may not be able to remember his code for the copy machine or get his book orders in on time. But if there was one thing Tony Stark could do better than 95% of his colleagues, it was work a crowd. Historians of weapons technology in World War II have the blessing and the curse of being spoiled for choice, he began. The atomic bomb, the cavity magnetron, and even the disastrously ill-made and unconscionably named Pan Jam drum, the Second World War produced no shortage of objects designed to alter and shorten the course of human life. Tony paused for a sip of coffee, allowing himself to glance toward Pepper and Bruce so that he could steady himself with the sight of their thumbs up and encouraging nod, respectively. Pepper, bless her, had her phone set to record, and Tony had no doubt she'd be emailing the file to Rhodey. With so many material forces to choose from, why start with biography? Tony continued. Why look at people? After all, the great man theory of history is dead. Few mourn it, and those few I would not want to emulate. And yet here I am writing a book organized around individuals. So what gives? One explanation is that I found my way into the subject of tonight's talk by following a great woman, Peggy Carter, one of the highest level agents at the SSR, and an absolutely crack shot, by the way. Tony clicked to the next slide, which displayed his favorite photo of Carter. It was a wartime shot, and she was in uniform leaning back against a jeep in the midst of a group of soldiers. Tony had always loved its candidness, the easy posture Carter adopted with the enlisted men, and he glanced out at the audience to check its effect. For reasons Tony didn't want to examine too closely, the first person his eyes found was Dr. Grant, who gave the photo the briefest of looks before staring back down at the notebook in his lap. His face looked pinched, and Tony resisted the urge to start grinding his teeth, already anticipating Grant's four-point objection to the way Tony had framed the gendering of historiography. "The other answer," he plowed on, deliberately shifting his line of sight away from Grant and his infuriating notebook, "is even more central to my argument about the existing narrative of the SSR. The stories we think we know about this organization, I suggest, have placed so much emphasis on the engineering and circulation of weaponry that they've overlooked the human agents consumed by and for those weapons. Take, for example, this sketch of Sergeant James Barnes by Private Stephen Rogers." He just advanced his presentation to the next slide, a photo of one of the sketches he'd found in Rogers' files, when he caught a sudden movement out of the corner of his eye. He glanced up from his notes just in time to see a flash of shock passing across Dr. Grant's features. The expression was brief but powerful, a deeper surge of emotion than Tony had seen from his new colleague, even in the heat of their worst arguments. Grant had been staring fixedly at the slide, but now his eyes flashed back to Tony's, and the look on his face was so searching that Tony found himself blinking in confusion, his train of thought completely derailed. He continued eloquently, right, the sketch. The sketch seems to have been completed sometime in 1943. It is accessible nowhere in the world except for in the library of Brooklyn Community College, where Peggy Carter made a generous donation just before her death. On their own, many of the documents in the collection might look unremarkable, just another paper trail plotting out the places where a human life brushed up against the bureaucracies of war. But it was by paying attention to the personal coordinates of these materials that I got turned on to the importance of the 107th Infantry Regiment. Tony managed to get through the rest of his talk without further stumbles, though he couldn't help but dart surreptitious glances at Grant as he laid out his new theory about Carter's involvement with a covert squad of former POWs. He expected to see Grant looking skeptical about some of Tony's larger reaches. Tony had made substantial progress with his inquiries into Dugan, Barnes, and Merida, but he didn't exactly have incontrovertible evidence to connect the 107th to weapons testing for Project Rebirth, and he'd come prepared to bullshit spectacularly when pressed. But ever since the first sketch, Grant had continued to look distracted, almost unwell, and when his hands stayed clenched in his lap through the entire Q&A, Tony found himself vibrating with a feeling that he decided to label irritation at a colleague's refusal to provide valuable feedback. It wasn't disappointment or even frustration, and it definitely wasn't concern, which is what he was explaining patiently to Bruce while they mingled over cheap wine and cheaper crackers during the reception. It was so obvious he wanted to say something, but he was holding himself back. Why? Tony demanded, helping himself to one of the riper-looking melon chunks from Bruce's plate. The guy's probably got more of a comment than a question tattooed on his ridiculously oversized biceps, but he just sits there in silence. Maybe not talking is a new tactic to throw me off. Or maybe he felt awkward getting involved in your historical crush on Steve Rogers, Bruce suggested, sighing and surrendering his plate of snacks to Tony. Excuse me? My what? Tony replied. I do not have a historical crush on Steve Rogers. I have a rigorous, methodologically innovative, and soon-to-be-discipline-redefining research focus on Steve Rogers. My orientation here is completely professional. But while we're on the subject, have I mentioned Rogers did a breathtaking sketch of the Church of Santa Maria Antica that's almost perfectly proportional? This isn't going to be another 21 reasons why Nikola Tesla could get it saga, is it? Bruce asked, wearing an expression that Tony found to be melodramatically long-suffering. Because I have exams to grade. Yeah, go do your grading, Banner, Tony muttered, clapping a hand on Bruce's shoulder as he passed back his now empty plate. I'm just going to go offer Grant a penny for his most hot and judgy thoughts. Tony, Bruce groaned. What? Tony asked, pressing one hand to his chest in a display of innocence. How will I ever get better, Brucey, if I don't engage thoughtfully with my toughest critics? He left Bruce shaking his head ruefully and wound his way through the remaining crowd to the wine table where Grant had gotten trapped by Eric Koenig from Philosophy. Grant's eyes flickered to Tony's nervously as Tony approached, and for a moment, Tony was tempted to leave him to his fate. So it's a game? Grant was saying, managing to sound both confused and encouraging. And he might as well be lathering himself with honey, really, because that combination was absolutely irresistible to a pedant. It's an interactive strategy campaign, Koenig corrected him, leaning slightly further into Grant's space as if sensing weakness. We meet every Sunday in my basement to engage in battles of wit and skill. Students have to intern for a semester before they can participate, but I've been willing to waive that requirement on a case-by-case basis for those faculty who demonstrate an aptitude for the intellectual virtues. Grant was nodding along gamely, clearly unaware of the net being cinched tight around him, and Tony finally relented. Not even a glass-juggling, meeting-prolonging pie thief deserved to be tricked into LARPing with the philosophy department. "Sorry to interrupt, but I have to borrow Dr. Grant here," he announced, wrapping a hand around Grant's upper arm for reasons that were purely tactical. "There's an oil paint-related emergency in the Fine Arts building that is very real and definitely not something I'm making up right now to get him out of this conversation. Thanks for coming. Always a pleasure to get another question about ontology from the author of both 10 Ways of Thinking About Ontology and 10 More Ways of Thinking About Ontology." "That was a little rude," Grant observed as Tony pulled him away, though Tony noticed his shoulders relaxing as they moved away from the table and the active threat of extracurricular strategy games. "Normally, I'd offer advice about how impossible it is to reason with a department committed to wearing shorts in all weather, but I seem to remember someone telling me, quite heatedly, that he could form his own impressions of his colleagues, so you can just consider that little rescue a one-time freebie." Tony had intended it as a barb, a bit of spice to season the pan for a verbal sparring match he'd been anticipating all day, but he found a very different kind of warmth spreading through his chest when Grant gave him a small, wry smile in return. "Maybe I could have used some of that advice, you know, on occasion," Grant offered. "I think the assistant dean may have me on some kind of list." "Oh, you mean the list for people who email the faculty listserv to say that proctoring software is, how did you put it? Cop shit? Yeah, you're going to be getting a really uncomfortable new desk chair delivered to your office in the next few days." Grant chuckled, and this interaction was getting away from Tony somehow. He'd come here for a fight, or to get crucial constructive critiques of his work. Definitely not to stare at the way Grant's eyes crinkled just slightly at the edges when he laughed. "You didn't say anything about my talk," Tony pointed out, trying to get himself back on track. Grant's face blanched again, his brows furrowing in a way that made Tony suddenly want to backpedal. "I was surprised," Grant replied, his voice tense and weirdly careful. "I know a little bit about the time period, but I had no idea Peggy, or that anyone would have saved." He cleared his throat. "I didn't know any of that kind of material had survived." "Yeah, me neither," Tony agreed, at a loss to account for the nervousness in Grant's posture. It seemed unlike him to keep it to himself if he'd hated the whole thing. "Did you find anything else in the collection?" Grant asked carefully. "Anything about a code name? Or a shield?" Tony's eyebrows shot up at what seemed like a simultaneously vague and specific request, and he was about to press Grant with the follow-up when they were cut off by the sharp buzz of a phone. "Shoot, sorry," Grant muttered, digging his cell phone out of his pocket. "I have to take this. Your talk was really something, Dr. Stark. Thanks for finding those things." And with that, he whirled away, leaving Tony blinking in confusion as he watched Grant stalk down the stairs and whisper fiercely into his phone. "What the fuck?" Tony asked, rhetorically, because the fourth floor was almost clear of people by now. He made his own way to the stairs, chewing absently at his lip as he tried to process why exactly Grant's question had struck him so strangely. He was sure he hadn't actually seen anything in the Carter collection about shield technology, but for some reason it sounded familiar. Could he have come across it somewhere else? Maybe in Erskine's notes, or... He paused for a moment, one foot still hanging above the bottom stair as his memory flashed back to the horrible weekend he'd spent carting his father's old things to a storage unit in Medford. He'd made only a half-hearted attempt to sort through the mess before shoving the rest of the boxes toward the back and picking up stress donuts for the drive home. But suddenly he felt absolutely certain that among the items he'd examined had been a faded black notebook covered with a diagram sketch of a circular, star-patterned shield. It could be a complete coincidence, Tony reflected, finally completing his step to the ground floor and resuming his progress back to his car. His father had worked briefly with military operations during World War II. His stories had been part of the reason Tony developed his interest in the field. But he'd never mentioned Peggy Carter, Colonel Phillips, or anything to do with high-stakes weapons development. And despite his lack of professional success later on, Howard Stark hadn't exactly been known for humility about his work. And yet, now that Tony thought about it, there had been a story his father had seldom told unless he was past his fourth tumbler of whiskey, and then he told it every time. It had involved some inscrutable connection between serving as a pilot on a search and rescue for POWs and discovering the best fondue in Lucerne. Maybe it wasn't too much of a stretch to wonder if the prisoners in question could have included members of the 107th. Tony strode out through the front doors of the library, mentally weighing whether he could squeeze in a trip to the storage unit before his first class the next morning, when he noticed Dr. Grant was standing at the curb next to a dark van. He'd been absorbed in a tense conversation with two men in dark suits, but moments later, one of the men opened the back door to the van, and Grant climbed in, escorted on either side by the two strangers, who, as Tony realized a moment later, were totally, definitely armed. "What the fuck?" Tony muttered for the second time, and suddenly Grant's canceled classes seemed like they might actually be a big deal after all, just not for the reason Tony had imagined. Chapter 5. As it turned out, Tony did have time to squeeze in a trip to the storage unit the next morning because he woke up to an email announcing that all classes at Stanley College were canceled in expectation of a blizzard. The better part of valor might have reminded him that his ancient Honda Civic wasn't exactly a road warrior in inclement weather, so perhaps a drive to Medford should not have been attempted under current conditions. But the worser part of desperation that kept him up until the wee hours of the morning watching Dummy hit his cardio peak zone on the wheel and speculating about when and where his father might have crossed paths with the names in his research notes, and in any case, the worst of the storm wasn't expected until later that afternoon. That line of reasoning was still holding up, barely, by the time that Tony arrived at the storage facility, where his car only took a second longer than usual to come to a stop in the first 2 inches of snow. He took a few moments to prepare himself for the cold and for the possible disappointment of a wasted trip, and then he bundled up to face the results of his risky crosstown drive. Of course, this whole process would be a lot easier if he had taken time to catalog the contents of the unit on the previous visit, or if his dad hadn't been such a goddamn paranoid hoarder in the first place, Tony amended. "What a fucking mess," he sighed, staring at the boxes of discarded drawing plans, dog-eared books, and semi-functional gadgets littering the concrete floor. The detritus was years thick. Howard had never been able to let go of a single coffee tin or sheet of paper that bore any connection to his time working with the military. And until the day his father wrapped his car around a utility pole, it had remained unclear to Tony whether the fixation was in spite of the war's negligible effect on his future prospects or because of it. Whatever the reason, Howard had continued to stockpile collections of junk in old office buildings or the garages of distant relatives, any place he thought might save them from his wife's efforts to maintain household order. If he and Tony had had a better relationship, or any relationship really, perhaps Tony might have someday learned why a box full of failed blueprints had mattered more to Howard Stark than his only child. "All right, focus up, champ," Tony told himself bracingly. "Snowmageddon's coming, no time to get maudlin." Tony groped back in his memory, trying to picture what else had been in view when he had last seen the notebook in question. Maybe a metal case of old Kodak film, he thought, as he picked his way through the piles, or what had looked like a partial model for a park. After what felt like hours, but was probably more like minutes, Tony finally caught sight of the object he'd been searching for. sticking partway out from underneath an old leather suitcase, was a faded black notebook and the corner of a diagram of a shield etched in blue and red ink. Tony took a deep breath before cracking the cover, sending up a prayer to the patron saint of archival miracles. "Please don't be a list of secret lovers," he whispered fervently. And then he peeked inside. It took him a few minutes to understand what he was seeing. The first pages were so dense with notations and calculations that Tony's eyes did quick circuits of the words vita radiation, nitramine, and vibranium before landing on the ones that made him let out a distinctly unprofessional whoop: Project Rebirth. Test subject Steve Rogers exhibited remarkable results, the paragraph announced, the letters pressed tightly together as if under stress. However, after destruction of the remaining materials in the Hydra attack, Project Rebirth is officially DOA. All affiliated research has been classified permanently to protect the identity and unrepeatability of the Captain America initiative. Tony had to reread the lines three times, his mind racing through a maze of implications. His father had met Steve Rogers, had actually worked on Rebirth, and had somehow been sworn to such a degree of secrecy about it that Tony had never heard either name pass his lips. And if the original materials for the weapons project had been destroyed, that might explain why so few mentions of the project had slipped past the censors. Of course, that explanation raised as many questions as it provided answers. HYDRA was an acronym Tony had never come across, for example, not to mention, "What the fuck is Captain America?" Tony muttered out loud. A knock on the side of the wall outside the unit interrupted his thoughts, and Tony looked up to see a U-Haul employee standing tentatively by the sliding door. "Hey, man, it's really starting to come down out there," he said apologetically. "Boss says we've got to close up shop." "Sure, yeah, of course," Tony replied, tucking the notebook into the inside pocket of his overcoat. "I'll get out of your hair." He made his way back to his car, noting with some apprehension that the storm had taken a definite turn toward wintry mix while he'd been inside. The smart thing to do probably would be to head straight home, but Tony had left the file folder with his copies from the Carter Collection in his office on campus, and if he had to wait another 24 hours before he could compare the two sources, there was a 50-50 chance that he was going to crawl out of his own skin. "I've driven through worse," he promised his car as he pulled out of the slushy parking lot and headed towards Stanley College. 30 minutes later, Tony was forced to admit that he had not, in fact, driven through worse. His knuckles were white around the steering wheel as he made his way gradually down a back road, leaning forward to try to peer through the pounding sleet. It was getting nearly impossible to see further than the next 10 feet, and he was over halfway there already, so turning back would be even more time in the snow than just continuing on his way. He could easily wait out the worst of the storm on campus. He had a key to Pepper's office, and her couch was the most comfortable to sleep on if it came to that. But a few blocks out from the college, the visibility was so bad that Tony was considering pulling over and seeing if 10 minutes would help. Just as he was thinking about looking for a spot to wait it out that wasn't just putting him in more danger of being rear-ended, the tires lost traction, and Tony felt the car start to skid. Shit! He slammed on the brakes, and the ABS kicked in, but it wasn't doing much as his car fishtailed around and slid onto the other side of the road. He went backwards off the road and onto the grated shoulder with a soft crunch. Holy shit! Tony leaned forward until his face touched the steering wheel and focused on taking even, calming breaths until his heart rate slowed. Holy shit. It took some effort to open his door as the snow had drifted up against it and jammed it closed. With some shoving, he was able to push enough aside that he could slip out. He did his circle around the car, starting to sweat as he hauled himself through the deep drifts. And thankfully it was undamaged save for a slight dent in the back bumper. It was bitterly cold, though the falling ice seemed to have stopped while Tony was deep breathing. and all that remained was the biting wind and the snowdrift Tony's car was currently attempting to mate with. He got back in and put it in first, tapping the gas to see if he could get any traction. Completely unsurprisingly, the wheels just spun, digging him deeper into the snow. "Fuck," Tony groaned. God, he was such an idiot. Choosing to go out today instead of just watching Gilmore Girls with Dummy in his sweatpants and calling it a day off. The tow truck was going to charge him exorbitantly for this, and it could be hours before it'd even get here. Tony wasn't sure how long his car battery would hold out to keep the heater on. He was digging around in his bag for his phone when a flash of light drew his eyes up, and he saw a car pulling deftly over to the shoulder beside him. Tony opened the door and stepped out, hastening to show the Good Samaritan that he wasn't hurt. It wasn't just a random helper that stepped out of the other car, however. It was Dr. Grant. There was a beat where they just stared at each other. Then Grant looked at his car. "You okay?" "I'm fine. Trevor is stuck." Grant laughed. "You named your car Trevor?" "My boyfriend, the last 3 years of grad school. At least it wasn't a tattoo." "Fair point." Grant walked around behind Tony's car. "He's pretty well stuck." "I had noticed that." Grant took his jacket off. "Okay, you drive forward, I'll push." "I don't think that'll work. I keep digging myself deeper. I'll just drive you into the snow and then roll back over you. Trust me, I'm pretty good at this sort of thing." "The physics don't make sense. I have to call a tow truck." "Tony," Grant said firmly, "trust me, okay?" Tony was helpless to say anything other than, "okay." He climbed into the front seat and started the car again. He popped off the e-brake and had barely touched the gas before his car was jerking forward right up the hill, out of the snow, and back onto the shoulder. "Whoa." He pulled the brake again and switched the car off. Grant had appeared at his side, and he opened the door. "No problem at all," he said. "How on earth did you do that?" Grant shrugged. "I've been stuck before. It's about applying force in the right spot. I barely hit the gas." Tony stared down at his own feet. "It doesn't take much." Grant peered close, frowning. "Hey, you still look a little pale. You headed to campus?" Tony nodded. "Okay, I'm going to follow you. And then, will you come to my office for some coffee after? You must have nearly had a heart attack spinning out. The shock might hit you later, and you shouldn't be alone." "Sure, yeah, okay," Tony agreed, still looking at his feet and wondering how on earth his car had magically propelled itself up a snow-laden 20% incline. "Okay, good. Are you sure you're good to drive? I could drive you in and take the taxi back to get your car." No, I'm okay, I'm fine. I'll go slowly." "All right." Grant watched Tony settle back in his seat and reclip his seatbelt, then he swung the door shut and walked back to his own car. Tony took a moment to compose himself, making sure he was truly focused on driving, then pulled back out onto the empty street. He drove exceptionally slowly, Grant puttering on behind him, but the lack of blowing ice pellets made everything much easier. It wasn't long before Tony was pulling into his parking spot. He'd lost track of Grant in the parking lot since their spots were on opposite ends of campus, but he knew where Grant's office was, and he decided not to ghost on their date, arrangement, agreement, thing, coffee. If he did, Grant would probably come storming into his office all huffy and demand to take him to the hospital for a head injury anyway. Tony went straight to the Fine Arts building, his burning need to recover his file folder knocked sideways out of his head by the near crash, and found Dr. Grant's office. "Hey, Dr. Stark, how are you feeling?" "Tony, please," he said, reaching out to shake Grant's hand. He found he liked the way it had sounded coming out of Grant's mouth earlier, and there was only a 43% chance it was the commanding, assured way he'd said it. "Thanks again for helping me out. Though I still don't get how you did." "You better call me James, then." "You sure you're not hurt, right? You still feel okay?" "Oh, yeah, for sure." It was a very low-speed spin-out, and the snow was still soft, not even an elbow bump. Tony wobbled his elbow to show how fine it was, and James laughed. All right, if you're sure. He turned back to his French press and started counting out scoops of delicious-smelling coffee grounds. So what brings you in on a snow day? Disastrously poor impulse control, Tony replied. Strangely enough, I figured that part out, James offered, the barest hint of a smile tugging at the side of his mouth. Rude, Tony observed, but he found himself returning the smile nonetheless. He took advantage of James's focus on coffee preparations to scan the shelves of his office. They were a bit on the bare side. Tony supposed that traveling light must come with the territory for a short-term position, but James had made the most with a minimalist style, including a few gorgeous modernist prints, a collection of poetry from the Harlem Renaissance, and what looked like a first edition of the Dubliners. Nearly tucked behind a stack of binders on top of the filing cabinet was another frame with a faded sketch of Lake Como that looked vaguely familiar. Tony couldn't put his finger on the artist, but it looked like it could be an original. No photographs of family, Tony noticed. Merely as a professional observation, of course. If he filed that information away for any reason, it was a further evidence that Dr. James Grant was a workaholic, which was perhaps something they had in common, Tony allowed, accepting his coffee in what must be the only campus office currently in use. So which impulse didn't you control this time? James asked, taking a slow sip from his own mug. I was following up on a tip you gave me, actually, Tony replied. Last night, before you got your mysterious phone call and climbed into a shady van with a bunch of Men in Black cosplayers, you asked me if I'd come across any references to a shield. Ah, yes, James replied slowly, his brow furrowing. Sorry, I'm not sure what I was thinking of exactly. I was a little distracted after the talk. Things have been tense with my, volunteer work. Volunteer work? Tony repeated, his eyebrows shooting up. What, like painting on-demand murals for the FBI? James snorted, then seemed to think better of it, and he quickly schooled his expression into something more neutral. I'm on call as a volunteer firefighter, he explained, his voice taking on the even carefulness Tony had first noticed at the YMCA. It was a transparent lie. Tony hadn't heard a line so poorly rehearsed since he'd poked his head into Parker's girlfriend's latest rehearsal of Cats, but for some reason he found himself reluctant to pry. You're not in trouble, are you? He asked James cautiously. Because seriously, I wasn't joking about the college's life insurance policy, and the health insurance is even worse. James gave him a larger smile this time, one that reached almost all the way to his eyes. I'm not in trouble, Tony, he confirmed. Well, not any more trouble than you are, seeing as we're both going to be trapped here for at least another few hours. Could be worse, Tony allowed. And he found, somewhat horrifyingly, that he meant it. He'd been chatting companionably with James ever since the snowbank, and it wasn't making him feel like knocking himself out with a paperweight. In fact, it was kind of nice, really. Almost cozy, after the adrenaline of hunting for the notebook and the stress of navigating the disastrous roads. Would you like to... James hesitated. Sit down for a while, see if we can wait it out. I wouldn't mind the company. Tony felt a flutter of nerves that was both familiar and not, a slight racing of the pulse he'd felt at the gym, and again when he saw James walk into the room for his talk, and suddenly a truly terrible suspicion started to take shape in his mind. Fuck, he thought to himself furiously. What am I, 15? I should go, actually, he blurted out, trying to ignore the quick flash of disappointment on James's face. Gotta get the files from my office, and then I'll probably just look through them there, get in a few hours of work. Or, you know, hurl myself into a snowdrift and let nature take its course, Tony finished silently. Sure, of course, James said, his face composed again. I'm behind on my grading anyway. Well, then you're officially one of us, Tony replied, trying to add a quick smile to smooth over his abrupt departure. Thanks for the coffee, and the one-man AAA roadside rescue, I owe you a drink. In a totally professional way, something extremely neutral and workplace appropriate, the men's warehouse of drinks, if you will. James wrinkled his forehead in confusion, and Tony judged that his chances for making a graceful exit were plummeting by the second, so he opted for a jaunty salute and then pivoted toward the door. Smooth, Stark. Incredibly smooth. As if this year hadn't already been enough of a mess, now he had to deal with a crush on Dr. Workplace Sedition, but make it sexy. As he rebundled his scarf around his neck to prepare for the cross-campus trudge to his office, Tony made a concerted effort to put James Grant and his soft snowdrift-conquering smiles out of his mind. He needed to focus on the essentials, like figuring out what Steve Rogers' role was in Rebirth, and discovering who in the hell had been goofy enough to name a weapons project Captain America. Chapter 6. It took 3 hours of pacing his office, 30 minutes of leaving increasingly frantic voicemails for Bruce about the status of Operation Kill the Inappropriate Crush with Fire, 20 minutes of scraping half an iceberg off his car, and then an additional hour of driving carefully in the wake of a snowplow before Tony made it home again. The wisest course of action at that point would probably have been to take a hot shower and go straight to bed. So, of course, 20 minutes later, Tony had arranged all his research notes on the remaining floor space of his study so that he could examine them all simultaneously while perching on top of his desk with a bag of Rainbow Chips Ahoy and a reheated mug of coffee he hoped had been brewed within the last 2 days. "I know what you're thinking," he murmured to Dummy, who was busily nibbling on a much healthier snack in his cage. "But I think we're still at least 3 steps away from a beautiful mind territory here." He paused to consider the half-eaten bowl of Rocky Road that was partially covering his photocopy of Dum Dum Dugan's enlistment form. "Well, 2 steps anyway." The problem was that the discovery of his father's notebook had made the web of connections between Tony's data points seem even denser than he'd imagined. Howard's notes were often frustratingly short on narrative detail, but Tony had been able to piece together a few bits of information to add to the whiteboard propped against the back wall, which now read, 1. Erskine chooses Steve Rogers to test Project Rebirth in 1943. 2. Project Rebirth sabotaged by Hydra, secret Nazis, the same year. 3. Rogers re-recruited by Carter and Phillips for Captain America Initiative, weapons codename equals S.H.I.E.L.D. 4. Rogers rescues and recruits POWs for Captain America Initiative, Barnes, Merida, Fallsworth, Jones, Dernier, Dugan. 5. Barnes goes missing, presumed dead. 6. Rogers goes missing, presumed dead. 7. Army Deep Sixes the data. 8. Carter makes another S.H.I.E.L.D.? Question mark. On the one hand, it was an incredible windfall, more facts to go on than Tony would have dared to hope for when he was staring at walls of redacted text at the Houghton. On the other hand, it still told him frustratingly little about the human elements of the story. Why had Steve Rogers volunteered for multiple, apparently quite risky, weapons initiatives? And why had such an illness-prone private soldier been chosen for operations so sensitive? What was it about Rogers that had moved Carter enough to hold on to his personal effects or to prompt the footnote about Rebirth having an incalculable effect on her life? And most importantly, for the purposes of his goddamn book, what weapons were Rebirth and the Captain America Initiative actually supposed to have produced? Tony heaved a sigh, running both his hands vigorously through his hair, as if he could shake loose a connection his brain hadn't grasped yet. He found his eyes lingering over a photocopy of Steve Rogers' sketch of the Oratorio di Santa Croce in Anzano, the soft pencil shading somehow managing to capture the effect of sunlight hitting the red tile roof. "What happened to you, Rogers?" Tony muttered to himself. He was startled out of his reverie by the pinging sound of a calendar alert from his computer. He pivoted on top of the desk to check the monitor and swore violently. Shit. In his excitement over his father's notebook, Tony had completely forgotten that the application for summer research funding was due by midnight. And so far, all Tony had was a completely unusable first line. "You know who I am." Tony shifted into a sitting position and pulled his keyboard into his lap to start typing. He framed the current state of his research as glowingly as he could, peppering in his most active verbs and writing the late-night coffee and ice cream buzz into a stirring promise that a full accounting of Project Rebirth would fundamentally change the way the field understood weapons development in World War II. The resulting document was still about a paragraph short, however, and Tony tapped a stray cookie thoughtfully against the side of his desk as he strategized. "Mace and Sitwell are on the committee this year," he observed to Dummy. "So we're going to put a little experiential learning cherry on top, and those pencil pushers are going to eat it right up." He illustrated his point with a jaunty five lines about his plans to model the production process for Project Rebirth with his summer research students, tied off the application with a nod to meta-history, and then hit send before the existential panic could seep in. The sheets of paper littered across his floor were starting to vibrate slightly as Tony tried to keep them in focus, and he needed to grab some sleep before he face-planted into a pool of rainbow-colored chocolate crumbs. Maybe the web of sketched faces and redacted forms would make more sense in the morning. The web of sketched faces and redacted forms did not make more sense in the morning, nor did its comprehensibility increase in any noticeable way over the following month of occupying Tony's study floor. What did increase, much to Tony's chagrin, was his crush on Dr. Grant. For the first week after their impromptu coffee date in James's office, Tony had almost been able to persuade himself the attraction was merely physical. It was true, after all, that the first time he'd spotted James in a suit at his students' gallery openings, Tony had tripped over a perfectly flat floor. But by the time he caught himself staring dopily at the wrinkle of concentration on James's face, as he tried to understand the assistant dean's pitch for the vital importance of take an intern to lunch day, Tony had to admit the situation was far worse than that. Between the two problems, the stalled research and the accelerating infatuation, Tony spent the month of March a little distracted, and that might have been why, on this particular Thursday, he had forgotten to download his PowerPoint on the Cuban Missile Crisis until midway through his afternoon section of American History 2. He had just toggled over to his college email account to rectify the oversight, taking advantage of a free moment where the students prepared their discussion questions in small groups, when he saw the Google alert pop up in his inbox. It wasn't the alert he'd set up at the beginning of the year to catch any mentions of Peggy Carter, he realized a moment later. It was one he'd set up 2 weeks ago, partially out of idle curiosity and partially out of a book proposal-related panic. And apparently it had paid off because someone had just published a blog entry that mentioned Howard Stark. "We're going to take a few more minutes in small groups," Tony announced to the class, already pulling up the blog in question. "If you've finished your two questions, try and come up with a bonus question that links today's topic to a piece of pop culture. The more obscure, the better." And speaking of obscure, Tony thought to himself, this blog was pretty far off the currently trending path. It had a fairly inauspicious title, Forgotten Genius, and it seemed to consist of somewhat crankish deep dives into lost or failed inventions. Tony quickly scanned the entry about his father and saw a few words he'd come across before, vibranium and vita radiation, and at least one word that seemed to stretch the bounds of credulity, slinky, and a concluding sentence that sent an instant shot of adrenaline running through his system. Though Howard Stark was never able to capitalize financially on his work for the U.S. Army, Rumors in the weapons tech industry suggest that he was later instrumental in the transformation of the SSR into a government organization known as SHIELD. "Fuck me, it's an acronym," Tony muttered. "Dr. Stark?" a student in the front row asked hesitantly, and Tony blinked at her for a moment before remembering where he was. "Great work today, everyone," he said loudly. "In fact, let's reward ourselves. We'll circle back to these questions on Thursday. Everyone go take a nap, or start that paper that's due tomorrow, or grab a soft serve or something." The student stared back at him for a long moment. "Is this a test?" a sophomore named Miles asked carefully. "No, seriously, you nerds, get out of here," Tony replied, and they shot out of their desks almost in unison. Tony took a minute to throw his books and notepads haphazardly into his bag and then cleaned off the chalkboard with one hand while he pulled up the photos of his dad's notebook on his phone with the other. By the time he walked out of the room, he was already swiping over to the final page, the one he'd transcribed as "Making a New Shield." "Thanks for being sloppy with the punctuation, Dad," he muttered as he reread the paragraph, inserting the missing periods. "Got the order to send the last of my research on the Captain America initiative to Carter, who is now in charge of forming SHIELD." "Fuck me," Tony said again, loudly enough that a nearby student jumped and almost fell off his skateboard. "Sorry about that." He waved his hand apologetically before turning his attention back to his phone. Here he'd been thinking that Steve Rogers and Project Rebirth might be the key to a new narrative about the SSR, and the entire time, there'd been a whole goddamn secret government agency sitting right under his nose. He switched over his screen to his contact list and dialed Rhodey, the closest person he could think of to a government contact, because he had to tell someone, and he was far too impatient to wait until he could come back through his notes at home. He paced up and down the stairs to his building while the phone rang, doing his best not to startle any more unsuspecting students. "Tony," Rhodey's voice greeted him a moment later. "I swear to God, if this is another, would you rather fight one bear-sized raccoon or four raccoon-sized bears phone call?" "The answer was so obviously the raccoon-sized bear, Sugar Plum, but we don't have time to relitigate your wildly insufficient fear of rabies, because I have just discovered a whole goddamn secret government agency." Tony couldn't help but punctuate the last word with a triumphant wave of his arms, a gesture that, judging from the long sigh on the other end of the line, Rhodey could picture without seeing it. "I changed my mind. Can we go back to the raccoon bear?" "Ah," Tony protested. "Not so fast, Colonel. I could outrun a raccoon." "You're going to tell me why it took me 3 years of research and 48 years of life to find out that my father helped found some covert, document-redacting, archive-evading organization called SHIELD." A long silence followed, and when Rhodey spoke again, all traces of amusement had left his voice. "Listen to me, Tony. I don't know how you heard that name, but you have to drop that thread immediately. Do you understand?" "You've heard of them," Tony said in a stunned voice. "Wait, they actually exist and you knew about them?" "I can't talk about any of this over the phone," Rhodey replied. "But just take my word for it, you don't know what you're dealing with here. This shit is dangerous. Promise me you'll drop it until I can talk to you somewhere secure." "You mean anyone who knows something about SHIELD could be in trouble," Tony answered slowly, his mind racing back to the night of his research talk. "Stop saying that," Rhodey muttered in exasperation. "We have to get off this line. Do not do anything stupid." "Yep, you got it, Gumdrop," Tony replied absently, already picking up speed on his way over to the Fine Arts building. "Nothing stupid. Definitely dropping it." "Tony," Rhodey started, but Tony cut him off by hanging up the phone. He was probably going to pay for that later, but for the moment, all he could think about was getting to James's office as quickly as possible. Because if knowing about SHIELD was dangerous, James was in danger. James was the one who'd first mentioned the name to Tony, after all, and directly afterward he'd been picked up by men in suits and put into a dark van. Tony had to warn him about what he was dealing with. Tony had made it to the office door, his first time being back since the coffee date, and was just reaching up to knock when it swung open to reveal a scowling James. "Oh," he said, "Tony." "Hey, can we talk?" Tony pushed James backwards into his office and tugged the door closed behind him. It's not a great time, Tony." His eyes kept flickering over Tony's shoulder towards the door. "I won't keep you long, but I have something you really need to know, and it honestly can't really wait." "I have a class," James shifted towards the door. "They'll have a great time debating if there's a real rule. If the prof is 15 minutes late, they get to leave without consequences. Trust me, I know, James." Tony grabbed his forearm and, holy shit, was he hiding cement bricks in his shirt sleeves? Held it for a moment. "Seriously, this is important." James softened, his brow twisting from frustration to concern. Okay, sit down. What's wrong? Are you in trouble?" "I'm not the one in trouble." Tony breathed. He sat so they were knee to knee. "Okay, so let me explain this. I found this note in my dad's things after you mentioned something about S.H.I.E.L.D. And at first I thought it was a code name for a weapons project, but now I know it's a whole goddamn secret government agency." James' fingers twitched on his lap, and Tony looked up to see all the color had drained out of his face. Tony's mouth fell open. "You do know what I'm talking about." "Tony." "Look, James, I don't really understand what's going on here, but you're in danger. I think S.H.I.E.L.D. is monitoring Stanley College. I don't know why, but you said something to me, and then right afterward, those men in the van. Look, I think maybe the Captain America initiative never ended, or they're still trying to. I'm not sure, but I think they're..." "Tony." James's hand landed on Tony's knee. "There's something I have to tell you. I really think you're in danger. My friend told me..." James sat up sharply, turning towards the door like a dog listening to a whistle. "Shit." "What?" "You have to get out of here, okay? Go home. Call in sick. Take the rest of the day off. Please just go." "No, I'm not leaving until you tell me what the fuck is going on." James grabbed both of Tony's shoulders and stood, pulling him up with him like he was a rag doll. "Seriously, Tony, I don't have time to explain everything to you. I'm not who I say I am. But you were right about this being dangerous, okay? So just go. You'll be fine if you just go. And what about you?" "I can handle myself, trust me." "That's ridiculous. We need to, call the police. Call someone. This is insane. What about the students?" "The students are fine, Tony. They're after me, which is why you need to go." James grabbed Tony's arm and started dragging him out of the office. "After you? Why? What the fuck? You can't just push me around. Please, James. James, please." He finally slowed and turned back to Tony, distraught. "Just tell me what's going on." James took a deep breath and let it out slowly. "Tony, I'm not who I said I am. I'm Cap." A loud bang ricocheted down the hallway outside, and James snapped into deathly serious. He grabbed Tony's arm and manhandled him behind him. "Stay behind me," he commanded. "I'll get you out." "Out of what?" Tony flailed for a moment, then grabbed a handful of the back of James's shirt. He seemed to know what he was doing, so Tony's best option seemed to be to obey. James pulled the door open a crack and peeked out. His entire stance had changed, his shoulders broader, a military tension rippling through his body. And damn, now that he was flexing with purpose, he... Another bang snapped Tony's attention back to the immediate situation. He had to admit there was a chance he was in quite a bit of danger, so now was probably not the time to get lustful. James seemed torn, looking back at the office, then out into the hallway again. "Okay, I think the best move is to get you out. They'll look for me here, so it's not safe to leave you here. Stay close. What the fuck? Tony hissed under his breath. But he stayed right behind James as he slipped out into the hall, keeping a tight grip on a handful of his shirt. What the fuck? What the fuck? What the fuck? Shh. James reached back and gave Tony's wrist a comforting squeeze. He stepped out into the hallway and made a beeline for the door to the stairwell. But just as they were approaching it, the door banged out, and at least 8 men in tack gear with masks on burst through the door, guns first. Tony's heart jump-skipped into overdrive. Any hope that this was a prank Dr. Grant was playing on him evaporated. Those men meant business. That much was horrifyingly clear. James spread his arms and stepped backwards. Tony, run, he hissed. And Tony turned on his heel and ran. He looked behind him as he bolted full speed for the north stair, fully expecting James to be right behind him. But he wasn't. James was also running, but not behind Tony, toward the bad guys. Hey, Tony shouted. James flew at 2 of the men, catching them both across the chest and knocking them down. But instead of swarming him, the rest of the group pushed right past and took off towards Tony. Hey! Tony yelped. He turned for the stairs again, torn between wanting to help James and knowing that 6 weeks of Groupon-inspired kickboxing classes weren't enough to be any kind of help at all. But before he could reach for the other stairwell door, it opened too, and more men poured out. He was so fucked. There was another loud bang, and then a hot flush tingled in the side of Tony's arm. He looked down to see a tear in his shirt and a red stain. Huh. Tony! Tony looked back at James and just had time to register that he was somehow holding his own against 4 of the men, though he was still far too far away to do anything for Tony, before the butt of a gun appeared in Tony's peripheral vision and cracked against his head. He went down. Chapter 7. Tony woke up with the worst hangover he'd had since he drank an entire bottle of watermelon liqueur to wind down from his first AHA conference on the job market. He groaned and tried to roll over in bed, but his pillows were all mixed up and bumpy. Ugh. Shh, Tony. Take it slow, said a weirdly familiar voice. Had he picked someone up last night? Tony blinked his eyes open and found James looking down at him. Huh? He didn't remember picking up Dr. Grant, of all people. I guess I finally told you, he mumbled. Don't try and talk, Tony. Shh. What's going on? I think you have a concussion. Well, that wasn't sexy at all. Tony swiped a hand over his eyes and blinked them open again. Now that he could see, he realized they weren't in his bedroom. They were in a cement cell? And it wasn't pillows under his head. It was James's lap. Tony closed his eyes again. Well, fuck. That about sums it up. Tony took a few slow, tentative breaths, then started the process of levering himself up to a sitting position. To his surprise, he only felt a little dizzy and not at all queasy. The fight with the men in black started to trickle back in. I think I'm all right. James let out a sigh of relief. Thank God, I was really worried about you for a while there. What happened anyway? It's kind of hazy. We were attacked by Hydra agents. Tony's head spun. Okay, maybe we just put a pin in that for a moment. He leaned back against the cool cement. I'm going to be late for Friday's classes, aren't I? James chuckled. A little. Well, bet this comes up at my promotion review. They were silent for a moment while Tony tried to gently recover his bearings. Hey, Tony. Mm-hmm. When you were waking up, you said, guess I finally told you. Told me what? That I have a weapons-grade crush on you. Nothing, just, you know, concussion talking. Hmm. James's fingers landed gently on the back of Tony's head, making Tony's heart pound. At least your head's not bleeding. We should do something about your arm, though. Oh, yeah, because he'd been fucking shot. Tony twisted his arm around to look at the wound and was relieved to see it wasn't that bad, barely a graze, but it was still beating up with blood in a few places. Oof. Here. James walked over to the solid metal cot that stood in the corner of their cell and started tearing up the dusty bedsheets. The springs creaked ominously, and Tony decided he was glad he had woken up in James's lap instead. James folded the sheet so the clean side was on the outside and crouched in front of Tony. They were close enough that Tony could smell a hint of cologne. Dear Dick, he thought, now is very much not the time. Hold it up above your heart, James said. He took Tony's wrist gently in his fingers and lifted his arm, then wrapped the sheets around the wound. We'll be able to tell from the stain on the fabric how much blood you're losing. A slow trickle can be as dangerous as a sudden loss if it doesn't clot. Do you have any health issues that could make this worse? Anemia? Thrombophilia? Is that a fetish for Peter Pan's fairy? Tony asked, wincing at the soreness that was now seeping in everywhere. I thought you were an art professor, not an EMT. And no, I don't have any pre-existing conditions, though my health insurance seems to think I do, considering how frequently they send me questionnaires. I'm trained in first aid. Also, no, I'm not really an art professor. I thought that much was clear by now. Okay, so what the fuck? Tony opened his eyes again and peered at James, who looked weirdly contrite. I'm so sorry you got caught up in this. Tony's stomach was churning and his body was confused by James' closeness, so he pushed himself up to his feet and started pacing back and forth across the mostly empty cell, trying to outrun his nausea, but still keeping his arm folded up in the air. Okay, so I got as far as S.H.I.E.L.D. being dangerous, and something about Vita radiation and a project called Rebirth that led to a project called Captain America, which are both weapons initiatives. But I still don't even know what kind of weapons. He turned sharply and paced the other way. I've spent all year on it, and I just still don't understand why. Tony. James grabbed his good shoulder and stopped his path. What? You are the dumbest genius I've ever met. Tony, I'm Captain America. What? Tony repeated. Something weird was happening in his stomach. You're right about Captain America being a weapon, but it's not an object, it's me. Project Rebirth was the transformation that turned me into Captain America. The Vita radiation your father invented was the key to a super soldier serum that made me like this. James turned and lifted the entire metal cot clean off the ground with two fingers. He dropped it again, and the resounding clang and cloud of dust made it clear just how heavy it was. Okay. Wow. Well, that was sort of distressingly hot, but we don't have time to unpack that right now. You're Captain America. James nodded. My name is Stephen Grant Rogers. I was given the Captain America serum by your father in the 1940s. I've been undercover at Stanley College for the last 7 months, trying to root out a possible Hydra operative we suspected was using the school to recruit vulnerable students for their organization. What in the ever-holy fuck? Tony said flatly. You have to be, like, almost 100 years old. Yeah. There was a period in the middle there when I was inactive, so it depends on how you do the math. Tony opened and closed his mouth. James shook his head, but he was smiling. God, I can't believe you figured so much of it out. Coulson's going to be so pissed that you made us. Wait, Dean Coulson? Is he a good guy or a bad guy? He's my handler. He's one of the good guys. He's not a Hydra guy? Nope. Oh my God, he's going to kill me now. I know his secret. Oh my God. Steve's hand landed on Tony's shoulder. He patted it. I won't let him kill you. This is no laughing matter, Mr. Whatever Your Name Is. He's going to use that little flashy men in black thing and make me forget my social security number. Steve raised an eyebrow at him. Not convinced you know your social security number now.
Fair enough.
Tony gulped down a breath and realized it was surprisingly hard to pull in. He tried again and choked.
Hey. Steve pressed the fingers from his other hand to Tony's neck and waited until Tony met his eyes.
Tony, it's okay. Calm down, all right? Everything's going to be okay. Don't panic.
'Cause you're a hoopy fruit who knows where his towel's at?
'Cause I'm not going to let anything happen to you, he said seriously, and Tony's stomach did another flip-flop. They took you because you were with me, but I'm the one they want. All right, I'll get you out of this. I'll keep you safe.
Tony swallowed heavily.
Okay, he breathed. Steve did that dog hearing a whistle thing again and shifted in front of Tony. Just stay behind me and stay quiet, okay?
Quiet? Have you ever met me? Tony asked.
But he tried to look small and irrelevant behind Steve's back. Then something occurred to him.
Wait. You're Steve Rogers.
The Army private from Brooklyn Community College. You're the history crush. Oh, my God. You drew those sketches. The one in your office is an original because you fucking drew it. Oh, my God. Bruce is going to laugh so hard he's going to pull something.
History crush?
Steve asked. But the sound of footsteps echoed outside, then the clang of the door being unlocked, and Steve stepped in front of Tony again. It opened to reveal two of the men who had accosted them at the college, but this time they were unmasked. That probably wasn't a good sign, because bad guys, who knew you knew their identity, were less likely to be planning to let you out alive. And holy fuck, did Tony ever know one of their identities?
Sit well?
He peeked under Steve's arm.
What the fuck, dude? I wrote a letter for your tenure file.
Steve poked him, but it was too late. Sitwell's gaze had cut from Steve to Tony, but he didn't say anything, only smiled. Then he turned back to Steve.
Captain America, he drawled. After all these years.
Yeah, you've got me. You can let him go. You don't need him.
Sitwell laughed. Quite the ego you've got there, Dr. Grant. Actually, you're the gift with purchase.
Sitwell cut back to Tony.
Dr. Stark, we have a job for you.
What? Tony looked behind him as if there might be another Dr. Stark there.
You're going to make us our own Captain America, one that listens to the right orders. Then we can dispose of the superfluous one.
He grinned threateningly at Steve.
Tony blinked.
What? He repeated.
I don't know how to do that.
Yes, you do. You can't fucking lie to me, Stark. You emailed me a document last month that proves you can do what we want.
He pointed at Steve. You're going to make us that serum and you're going to do it fast.
A document. Oh, the fucking grant application with the experiential learning cherry on top, which he had handed right to fucking Sitwell. The one where he'd claimed he could show his students how to recreate the Project Rebirth process. The project that apparently made not a fancy lightsaber or gas-powered trebuchet, but a whole-ass fucking super soldier.
Shit.
Tony groaned and rubbed his hand over his face. He was feeling dizzy again.
It was a grant proposal, Jasper. You always overpromise in a grant proposal. I didn't even fucking know what Project Rebirth was when I signed that.
Bullshit. You knew then and you know now. Why else are you reading blogs about your father's Vita radiation technology at work? Why else are you all cozied up to Captain America? For all we know, you're a S.H.I.E.L.D. operative too, trying to determine the makeup of the serum so S.H.I.E.L.D. can have 100 Captain Americas. 1,000? Well, Hydra isn't going to let that happen, he hissed. You either make it for us, or the knowledge dies with you.
Tony crossed his arms.
Then it dies.
Sitwell smirked.
I thought you might say that. But consider this. We kill you, since we have no use for you, if you won't make the serum. We keep Captain America, maybe hollow out his mind and pour Hydra in instead, and then we start on your students. Tony blanched. What on earth do they have to do with this? Well, they're your students. If you can't reproduce it, maybe they can. Of course, if you agree to help us, we'll never have to find out. Fuck you, Tony hissed. Sitwell just smiled. Maybe I should go pick one up. The Parker kid, perhaps? Miss Lewis? I've been keeping very careful records on all of them, you know. Tony could feel the blood draining out of his head, and he breathed slowly and deeply to stop from wobbling. Leave them alone. It's a simple choice, Dr. Stark. Fine. Fine. I'll make it. I'll do it. Just, I need paper and a pen and time. I'll make you a list of what I need. The first two you can have. He snapped his fingers and one of the Hydra lackeys trotted off. The last you don't have much of. Get to it. He pointed at Steve. Take him and put him in room 3. Oh, no, you don't. Tony stepped around Steve to stand between him and the men. I need him. Sitwell's eyebrow went up. What? You think I can just throw sugar and spice and everything anabolic in a cauldron and poof, here's Rocky II? He paused. Like Rocky Horror, not Stallone. Upon reflection, that was a confusing analogy. Sitwell didn't look amused. Look, I'm going to need an assistant with immaculately steady hands, and anyone dumb enough to side with you probably doesn't have the attention span necessary to follow through with this. Grant, or Rogers, or whatever, is annoying as fuck, but at least he's not going to drop something and blow the whole damn place up. You want your serum? Leave him with me. Sitwell grinned. Fine, whatever. Keep your assistant. You might end up needing to drain him dry to use his blood anyway. No skin off our backs. Tony shrugged, like he didn't care either, and Sitwell chuckled. It wasn't like it was a secret among the faculty that he and Steve didn't get along, so any suspicion that they might work together to escape was best kept low. I don't care about your weird feud between S.H.I.E.L.D. and Hydra and TACO or whatever silly acronyms are involved. I just want my students safe, okay? I make this for you. You let me go and you leave my students alone. Sitwell nodded. Okay then, fuck off and let me think. The Hydra agent returned with the pen and paper and handed them over. They all left, locking the door with a clang behind them, and Tony turned to Steve. Steve raised his eyes to the ceiling, then raised his eyebrows as if to say they might be watching. Tony gave him a short, sharp nod. He took the paper and sat on the metal cot, sighing at the loud creak of springs. Steve paced back and forth for a while, then sat on the floor. Tony let himself panic for approximately 3.5 minutes. Then took a deep breath and set to work. He needed to provide Sitwell with a list of reasonable supplies to make the super serum. He had to do that while A, not having any fucking clue how to make it, and B, not having any fucking desire to make it for someone like Sitwell. So they needed to escape. And he had the opportunity to mail order whatever they might need to do so, but it had to be convincing enough that Sitwell wouldn't suspect it wasn't for its expected purpose. His only comfort was that Sitwell clearly had no fucking clue how to make the serum, or he'd just do it himself. Tony looked up and met Steve's eye. They needed to talk, but he agreed with Steve that it was highly likely the room was bugged in one way or another, and it suddenly seemed vitally important to keep everything they possibly could on the down low. I'm exhausted, Steve said. Something pointed in his tone. Tony looked at the tiny bed he was sitting on, the one tucked in the corner, with loud springs and very little space for two people. Well, I'm not sitting on the damn floor, he snapped back, but he held eye contact with Steve and gave a tiny nod. Steve made a show of sighing as he pushed up to his feet across the room. He stretched out on the bed, his face by Tony's hip. You better not snore, Tony said. He shifted down a bit just getting comfortable. Steve closed his eyes. Shield will be looking for me, he muttered softly, if I don't check in tomorrow. Tony folded himself over his paper, arms crossed over his head. What are the chances they'll find us? Good, but not necessarily that they'll find us quickly. Fuck. I know where we are. I was awake on the ride in and recognized this place. We're in the old SHIELD facility in Brooklyn, where I was turned into Captain America. It's been disused for years, and Hydra must have taken it over. They're probably going to have you using Erskine's old lab. Tony sighed. Of course it was New York. He always suspected if he died young, it'd be in New York. So, if there is a way to tell Coulson where we are somehow? That would certainly up the chances of getting rescued fast, Steve agreed. Okay. What are you thinking? I don't know. If I can get my hands on a phone or a computer, I could get a message to Rhodey. He's in Special Forces. He'd be able to get our message to Coulson. Or if not, he'd probably have the clearance to find us himself. But I doubt they're going to let me have either. It'll be all your dad manage this with an abacus and a plumb bob. We'll just have to keep pretending we're playing along and look for a chance. Okay. It wasn't solid as far as plans went, but Tony could see there wasn't really anything else they could do. He jotted down a few ingredients and supplies he thought might look convincing, and then threw in what it would take to make a small bomb and a sort of multicolored flashbang just for fun. About half an hour later, a guard came and took the sheet away. Steve had fallen silent while Tony wrote, and Tony couldn't tell if he was asleep or not, but he didn't want to strike up conversation when someone might be listening anyway. So after a long, boring hour perched on the edge of the cramped cot, he got up and started wandering around the cell in circles, looking for weaknesses. Or, you know, a forgotten cell phone dropped by a guard. Tony was subtly examining the far wall for the possibility of a well-hidden Tony-sized air vent when the door swung open and an agent waved a gun in Tony's direction. Come with me. Steve fell into step so close behind Tony that Tony could feel the heat from Steve's chest against his back. They were walked down a hallway to another room, which proved to be an absolute time capsule of a lab. Steve's breath sucked in sharply, and Tony couldn't help but think about the last time he was there. There was a large metallic cylinder in the center of the room, and inside were straps at leg and arm height. On a table in the middle of the room was a pile of Tony's requests. But that wasn't what caught his eye. What caught his eye was the adjacent security office up a set of stairs in what looked to be an old observation deck that contained one guard and one computer. Tony wanted nothing more than 3 minutes alone with that computer. Steve hovered nearby while Tony examined his ingredients. It wouldn't be too hard sneaking some stuff out. Surely the guard wouldn't be watching that closely the whole day, and Tony had a loose enough waistband that it wouldn't be hard to slide things in his pants. But a bomb wouldn't do them much good if SHIELD or the U.S. Air Force weren't on their way to rescue them. Tony waited until the guard was looking the other way, then whispered, I need a distraction at some point that gets me 3 minutes alone with that computer. Steve nodded once. Tony spent the next 2 hours methodically mixing a packet of powder that would bang loudly and flash a plume of multicolored smoke, likely to stand out in any context, except maybe a campsite with one of those magic fire packs. If nothing else, it could be a last-ditch effort to create a distraction, show a search team where they were, or draw the attention of local law enforcement. It had been a while since high school chemistry, but Tony'd always had the brains for it, and it came back to him easily. He set off a few small booms to make it look like he was actively doing something. The hard part in the end was managing to hide everything. The bomb, the flashbang, and a lighter about his person without risking blowing his own dick off. It was a computer that would be the real challenge. In the end, Tony decided to do what he was good at and start a heated argument with Dr. Grant. I don't fucking remember, he shouted, which drew Steve's immediate attention. What? I'm not a walking periodic table, okay? I can't believe the shitty circumstances they're expecting me to work under, Tony said loudly. I can't even look up which isotopes I need. And if I get this wrong, instead of reinventing vital radiation, I'm going to blow the whole damn place up. Steve's eyes cut over to the guard room, then back to Tony. I'm sure they don't want you to do that. I don't have a damn choice. What the fuck is up with your super secret organizations and trying to make everything 1,000 times more dramatic than it needs to be? If Sitwell wants me to make the serum so bad, the least he can do is give me access to my research notes. Well, what the hell do you want me to do about it? Steve snapped back, either playing along very well or actually getting mad. Ah! Tony threw his hands in the air. I might as well just blow the damn place up. He started scrambling through the supplies on the table, and a hand gripped his hair hard enough to bruise. It was the guard. What's going on here? I'm stuck, Tony said with a growl. Because Sitwell wants me to work under primitive circumstances. Sure, my dad managed this. But I'm not my dad. I'm a fucking historian. When things blow up in my line of work, it's usually a conversation about digital humanities on the H. Paul listserv. So if he wants me to succeed at this, I need at least a very detailed periodic table and access to Wikipedia. The guard grunted, "Don't move." He went back to the security room. Tony resisted the urge to catch Steve's eye, wanting to know if he saw the ploy for what it was, or if he was just so used to fighting with Tony that it came naturally. If Tony needed to apologize, there'd be time for that later. He watched the guard make a phone call through the window, then cheered silently when the man beckoned Tony up the stairs with a finger. Steve followed. You're allowed to use this machine to do research, take notes on paper, and bring it back down with you. I'll be watching. Great. Thanks. Tony stepped up to the computer, acting for all the world like this would solve all his problems, but the guard stood close behind him and watched his every move. Tony typed a few keywords into the search bar, and it was clear from the results that there was software installed to limit the computer's access, probably to keep the Hydra guards off white supremacy Twitter while on shift, but it did present a problem for Tony. It wouldn't be as easy as hiding a browser window in the corner of the screen. He needed to get around the software itself first. You know, the last time I was here, one of your guys set off a bomb in here, Steve said cheerfully, drawing the guard's attention for a moment. Then he shot and killed one of the best men I've ever known. The air temperature dropped a few degrees. The guard stayed quiet, eyes still on Tony, who was looking through PubMed with what he hoped was an expression of single-minded focus. Looks pretty different now. Steve moved around the room. We didn't have all this security stuff before, but it's... An alarm started blaring through the room, and the guard cursed violently, smacking his hands over his ears. Oops. You idiot, he shouted. Get away from there. Tony could hear them moving around behind him, but he didn't take the time to look. He opened the command line and poked through the installed programs until he found the parental control software. He almost laughed. It was the same one Stanley College used. Sitwell couldn't even do his own damn network security research. He was probably using college activation codes to run it. Well, he had fucked up big with that little moment of laziness because Tony had spent his entire first year at the school disabling this very software so he could check on his farm bill during class. It was a few clicks and he was free, in a new browser window that wasn't blocked. A few more clicks and he had a message box open to Rhodey, which he shoved down into the bottom of the screen as a tiny square that would hopefully be blocked by his shoulders. The alarm stopped blaring as he typed the emergency code word from their one-night stand days at MIT, followed by the hint that would hopefully lead S.H.I.E.L.D. right to them. Platypus, Coulson, Lab, Brooklyn. He hit send, closed the window, and switched back to PubMed, just as the guard shuffled back up behind him. Hey, Butterfingers, Tony said, maybe you should wait downstairs. Steve huffed a sigh and plodded off down the stairs. Tony stayed at the computer long enough to pretend he was discovering vital information, then headed back down to the lab where he spent the afternoon taking notes in code, actually a grocery list, and mixing chemicals with a tendency to smoke uselessly. Several hours later, a guard escorted them back to their cell for the night. As soon as they stepped back in the cell, Steve pulled Tony close. "It's sent," Tony whispered. "They're coming, and I made you this." He slipped Steve the bomb, the flashbang, and the lighter. Explodey. Flashy. "Okay," Steve said with a simple accepting nod. He shoved the three things in his pockets without a glance. Tony was briefly taken aback. His whole professional life was about convincing people he was as valuable, smart, and worthwhile as he claimed he was, an endless uphill battle over the past year in particular. And having Steve just accept he'd done his rather critical part of the plan so easily, especially when this was a world that surely Steve knew 1,000 times better, was blowing his mind a bit. He was used to a multi-stage review process. Okay. A guard arrived a few minutes later and shoved two food trays through the door, dry sandwiches and shriveled strips of carrot and celery that looked like they'd been bought for $40 at an airport. Tony picked at his. He itched to do something, but there wasn't much more to do. Steve was sure S.H.I.E.L.D. was coming for them, and for now, Tony had to trust that. He certainly trusted Rhodey. He could probably stretch out faking the serum for another day or two, but they'd hit a point pretty soon where Sitwell would demand progress, and if they hadn't been found, Tony would have to pull a rabbit out of his hat. Well, that was a problem for future Tony. Today's Tony had done enough. "I need to sleep," he announced. "Okay, one sec." Steve picked up their trays and dropped them by the door, and Tony saw him drop the bomb behind the hinge as well. He picked up one corner of the cot with one hand on the way back and dragged it over to the wall farthest from the door. "It'll be safer over here." He glanced back at the explosive, then looked at Tony expectantly. It was late. Tony was exhausted and frustrated, and he didn't have it in himself to argue that he ought to sleep on the floor so Steve could save his strength. He climbed in the cot and shifted back as far as he could, facing the wall, Steve tucked in behind him. "Don't worry," Steve whispered, face far too close for anything but a dangerously rapid heartbeat. "They'll come." Tony didn't sleep. It was too tense, pressed up side by side with Steve, his incredible body heat chasing away the chill but not the stress. It had to be well after 2 a.m. by the time Tony's body finally gave in and he slipped into a fitful doze. When Tony finally snapped back into full wakefulness, it was to the sound of gunfire echoing down the hall. Chapter 8. In the end, it was over before Tony really had a chance to process what was happening. Steve leapt out of the cot and lit the explosive, then ran back and deftly flipped the metal cot up, sliding over it somehow, magically, catching Tony before he hit the ground and curling around him, hands over Tony's ears. The charge blew, knocking the cot into Steve's back, but he didn't even flinch. "Stay right behind me," he whispered in Tony's ear, passing him the flashbang and the lighter. "Use this if you get in trouble." Tony grabbed a handful of the back of Steve's jacket and was dragged off down the hall. There was shouting, more gunfire. More than once, Steve turned to press Tony to the wall, his whole body a shield. And then they were out. The place was swarming with men in black. It looked like part of a converted factory, but Tony barely had time to process where they were before he was being hustled through the darkness to a collection of dark SUVs parked by the road. A heavy warmth settled over Tony's shoulders a moment later, and he turned to find Steve covering him with his jacket. "I can take you to a private S.H.I.E.L.D. medical office that can get you patched up. No questions asked." "What about you?" Tony asked. Steve nodded. "They'll check me over too, but I heal really fast, so I won't need much attention." "Right. Captain America. Convenient." Tony was fading now, the adrenaline giving way to overwhelming fatigue. "Okay." Steve wrapped his arm around Tony's shoulder, holding him up against his chest in a way that didn't press against the wound in Tony's arm, but also prevented anyone else from bumping it. He guided Tony through the men in black with targeted efficiency to a sleek black car that waited on the corner. "Medical ops, please," Steve said as he climbed in. And the driver just nodded and started the engine like Steve was fucking Lady Gaga or something. The swaying of the car was encouraging Tony's stomach to wonder if nausea was once again appropriate, so Tony closed his eyes and leaned into Steve beside him. Steve didn't seem to mind. If anything, he leaned in too. They arrived a few minutes later at a nondescript office building, and Steve guided Tony in through the front door, two agents flanking them. Tony blinked at them. They hadn't been in the car. Where'd they come from? Steve swiped a key card that looked like his faculty ID for Stanley College, but clearly was more than that, and the door beeped and unlocked. Behind it was a thriving office building, though the time of night meant many desks were empty. Steve led Tony down a hall and into a medical exam room, still keeping him close. Almost immediately, a white-coated doctor came in. "I'm Dr. Cho," she said. "Let's have a look at you, Dr. Stark." She seemed to already know everything about him and everything about what had happened to him because she targeted his head and his arm with nearly frightening efficiency. But the benefit was that Tony didn't have to talk much, just a nod to, "Does this hurt?" and a brief description of how he was currently feeling, tired, sore, like he was the prize in the claw game that someone had paid $300 to pick up and drop over and over. The gunshot graze needed stitches, so Dr. Cho numbed the area and sewed him up. She said the concussion wasn't too bad, but he should take it easy for a few days and call if anything worsened. She handed him a sleek white business card with nothing on it but a phone number that seemed a few digits too long. "You'll be just fine, Dr. Stark," she said with a smile. "Thank you." Tony's words were echoed by Steve's. And Tony realized with a start that he was still there, had been there the whole time, waiting silently in a chair by the cupboard. As soon as Dr. Cho left, Steve frowned. "Tony." He stood and crossed the room to stand in front of him, eyes cutting from where Tony could only imagine was still a cartoon-esque bump sticking out from the top of his head to the clean white bandage on his arm. "Tony, I'm so sorry. This was all my fault. The very last thing I wanted was for you to get hurt. The truth is, I..." There was a short, sharp knock, and Steve scowled at the door, then sighed, resigned, when it swung open to reveal Dr. Coulson. "Good evening." "You!" Tony pointed at him. "Fake Dean! Your pants are an inferno. I knew there was something funky about you." "I'm naming this year's ulcer after you, Stark," Coulson said blandly. "I need to debrief you." "Hotter men than you have tried," Tony declared. "Actually, to be fair, most of them succeeded, but I think of you more as a pain in my ass than a..." Coulson held up a finger. "For the love of all that is holy, please do not finish that sentence." Tony shrugged his unwounded shoulder. "Look, it's new territory to have a civilian know as much as you do. This is going to be a thing whether you want it to be or not. There are going to be meeting security clearances." The unshakable Coulson finally looked shook. But Steve stepped in. "Phil," he said softly, "I don't think Tony's a security risk right now. And Helen said he should rest. Can we do this on Monday? I will take personal responsibility for his temporary clearance. Please?" Coulson sighed. "All right. But you're both calling in sick Monday morning. You're coming here and we're getting this figured out. Deal?" Tony nodded, and so did Steve. Coulson left, and Steve held out a hand to help Tony hop off the tall exam table. "I'll get an agent to escort you home and check the security at your place." Tony was hyper aware of the hand that was still circling his waist, even though he was on his feet now. "Actually, I was hoping you might be able to take me home. I guess I still have some questions." Steve actually seemed to brighten at that. "Of course. I mean, I'm sure you have, Tony waved vaguely at the complex around them, meetings and stuff. My sole priority right now is you. The rest can wait. Sitwell and the other Hydra agents who survived are in S.H.I.E.L.D. custody. The students are safe. You're my only remaining concern. I won't tell anyone anything. I don't think they'd believe me anyway, Tony said. Steve's concerned frown softened into a hint of a smile. Not that kind of concern, Tony. I need to make sure you're okay, that you're safe, and you feel safe. Oh, well, yes. In that case, it would be great if you could come home with, take me home, escort. Nope, there's no saving that one. Take me home, Captain America. Steve chuckled. This time he didn't hold Tony by the shoulder, but he walked right behind him, close enough that Tony was sure if he stopped suddenly, there was going to be a fender bender. But Steve's fender wasn't one he much minded being bent over. God, he should have asked Dr. Cho if one of the side effects of being kidnapped by an evil international organization of supervillains was excessive horniness. Though it was becoming clear that it was much more likely to be a side effect of spending this long around Steve. The drive home was quiet too, but Steve seemed to be exuding less tension this time. Tony gave the driver directions to his townhouse, and when they pulled up to the building, Steve exited first, then gave Tony a hand out. Tony started. Do you mind if I do a quick check of your place? Now that we know you were targeted, just in case there's... Oh, yes. Yes, please. I'd like that, Tony said, like he was offering to save the last donut for him. He mentally smacked himself, then unlocked the door and stepped inside. He flicked the light on. Honey, I'm home, he called. There were immediate, furious, scrabbling sounds from Dummy's cage. Steve looked confused at first, peering around the wall like he was expecting to find Tony's secret husband there, but Tony just laughed and shook his head. He grabbed a handful of pellets from the bag under the cage and dumped them in Dummy's bowl, currently unable to do the math it would take to figure out if the little guy had actually missed a meal or not, and if yes, how much he was owed. He'd pay for it later, in midnight wheel squeaks, if he was wrong. He's cute, Steve said, bending down to watch the hamster start shoving kibble after kibble into his cheeks. His name's Dummy. Steve turned a devastating smirk on Tony. Also named after Nex? Tony barked out a surprised laugh. Yeah, pretty much all of them. Tony fiddled with the sleeve of Steve's jacket, which he was still wearing. That scent of cologne lingered in a haze around him. Only man in my life right now, he added, as if that was important. But Steve looked up at him like maybe it was, and the moment held until Tony cleared his throat and gestured towards the back door. That's a slider, but I have one of those wood thingies in it, and there's windows upstairs. Steve snapped back into Captain America mode and let Tony lead him around the townhouse, quick eyes flicking over everything. He even sniffed Tony's curtains, which only made Tony wish it was some kind of innuendo and not a check for, like, explosives or something. When Steve declared the place all clear, Tony let out a sigh of relief he didn't know he was waiting on. Okay, good. Thank you. Maybe I should check your office again? Steve suggested the window. Sure, Tony agreed too easily. They were doing some sort of awkward skit he didn't know the script for, but what he did know was that he didn't want Steve to leave. Tony showed him back up to the front bedroom that he'd converted into an office. He looked in the closet himself, while Steve ran a finger along the window frame. When Tony extracted himself from the closet, irony notwithstanding, Steve was looking down at the detritus of research that littered Tony's desk and floor. He reached out with one finger and slid a folder aside to reveal the copy of the sketch of James Barnes that Tony had found in Brooklyn. He picked it up, his face an unreadable mix of intense emotion. I can't believe you found this. Wow, it's hitting me all over again that you really drew that, like 70 years ago. Wow. Tony flashed back to C's face during his presentation.
Oh, God, no wonder my presentation upset you so much. I'm so sorry.
No. Steve held out a hand like he could redirect Tony's apology away from him.
No, you found this again. I never would have known that Peggy had this if not for you.
They told her I died. That was... Steve's voice choked with emotion, and he cleared his throat roughly.
Thank you. It's good to see it again.
As I've proven in the past, I don't really know much about art, but it's really beautiful. You're very talented.
Thank you. It was always my dream to go to art college, he said distantly.
BCC gave me a scholarship, but then the war. And Bucky was drafted, and I had to go. He laughed a little. I think I got a bit too caught up in my cover story this year. Too much fun.
That's only because you hadn't had to write your annual performance report yet, Tony said, trying to lighten the mood.
Gonna be tough to sell getting abducted by Nazis as service to the college.
And to his delight, Steve laughed.
You were very convincing, Tony continued.
I was convinced.
Steve set the sketch down and let out a soft breath. He turned back to Tony.
Tony reached for the jacket again. He needed to give it back. He needed to give it back and say goodnight, and I have a confession to make.
Steve's eyebrow popped up.
Oh?
And if you can't confess something to the man you just spent 30 hours locked in a cell with, then who can you? Am I right? You know what my blood looks like. That's pretty personal.
Steve smiled softly and took a half step closer.
Definitely.
So, I've kind of been sending you bad vibes all semester.
Steve's face did some complicated gymnastics and stuck the landing on trying and failing to not look bothered, which spurred Tony on.
And after giving it a lot of thought and watching a few self-help YouTube videos, I came to the conclusion that it was all sort of a bad reaction to me very much having quite an intense crush on you.
Steve's mouth fell open.
And, like, you're Captain America, so, like, that's probably normal of me, but, like, I think it's Steve that I actually have the crush on. Anyway, I just had a stroke right there and apparently thought that was something you should know. Concussion. Ignore me.
Steve took another step closer until they were close enough that Tony wouldn't have to move his hand far to touch him.
I don't want to ignore you.
Really?
Steve nodded. He reached out tentatively with one hand and rubbed his fingers across the lapel of his jacket.
Tony leaned forward into the touch, eyes fixed unwaveringly on Steve's face.
Steve's other hand took the other lapel, and Tony let his tongue dart out to wet his lips.
The movement caught Steve's attention, and he looked up from the jacket collar to Tony's mouth.
Do you really?
He asked softly, and Tony nodded.
Steve ducked down and pressed his lips to Tony softly, unassumingly, and Tony melted into it.
It was like all the churning uncertainty he'd felt from the day he'd first met Dr. Grant was going up in smoke. He felt perfectly confident that this was exactly where he was meant to be. But when Tony tried to push the kiss deeper, Steve pulled back, frowning now.
He moved his hands up from the jacket to cup Tony's jaw.
You should be resting.
I can rest with you, Tony said.
Then realized he'd basically asked Steve to spend the night and tried to figure out a way to backtrack it without uninviting him, because he was definitely invited. But to his relief, Steve smiled.
Do you promise to actually sleep if I stay and watch over you?
I mean, I promise to try. Very, very hard. You're pretty distracting, but I have years' experience sleeping in libraries and student centers, face down on a stack of prelim readings I was trying to absorb via osmosis. So I think it's probably worth giving it the old college try.
Steve laughed.
Okay, let me tell the driver to go. I'll find you a spare toothbrush.
It was domestic in a way that made the back of Tony's neck heat.
When they brushed their teeth side by side in Tony's bathroom, Tony gave him a towel and Steve went down to the guest bathroom to shower while Tony used the ensuite. Dressed in fresh pajama pants and feeling much less like roadkill, Tony snuggled under his sheets. Without hesitation, Steve dropped the towel, which revealed nothing but the boxers Tony had lent him, and smirked when Tony visibly enjoyed the view. He crawled into Tony's bed. They turned to face each other. "I'm not just flirting with you to get free overnight bodyguard services, you know." "What a relief. 'Cause that was a real concern of mine, what with you having an overabundance of self-preservation instincts." "Hey," Tony pouted. "Like an hour from now, I'm going to come up with a really scathing comeback to that." "Like an hour from now, you'd better be asleep," Steve said. He gathered Tony in his arms and drew him up against his chest. He still smelled ever so slightly like that cologne Tony couldn't name, and since he'd just showered using Tony's body wash, the only reasonable conclusion was that it wasn't cologne at all. Steve just smelled like that, naturally. Tony burrowed into Steve's chest and let himself be surrounded. His headache faded, the pain in his arm drifted away, and all he felt was warm and comfortable and safe. Tony snapped suddenly into wakefulness and opened his eyes, heart pounding. But Steve was still there, his face gorgeous as ever and even softer with sleep. It hadn't been a dream. Tony celebrated that revelation by kissing Steve's nose boldly. "Good morning." Steve made a soft, sleepy noise and blinked awake.
"What time is it?"
he asked, yawning. "Don't know. Don't really care." Tony couldn't stop his grin from growing to dangerous proportions. "You're here." Steve tugged Tony closer. "Of course I'm here." "For the record, I'm really glad you're here." Steve grinned back. "Oh, good." He kissed Tony softly, but it still ignited things under Tony's skin. And when Steve's fingers grazed his jaw, a little moan slipped out. "So," Tony started, "I have the distinct urge to thank you for saving my life." He pressed closer, and he could feel Steve's body reacting in the most delightful way. "So tell me, does Captain America put out on the first date?" Steve hummed consideringly. "Captain America is all serious and straight-laced and sexless," he said. But when Tony frowned, he leaned in and brushed his lips along the curve of Tony's ear. "Steve Rogers, on the other hand." Tony shivered and let his hands wander down Steve's back, finding teasing hints of muscle groups he couldn't even name, let alone activate himself. "Jesus." But then Steve stilled, pulling back a bit. "Tony," he cautioned, "you're still recovering." "I feel fine," Tony insisted. "Great, even. I'm 100% sure I read on WebMD once that the best cure for post-concussion syndrome is an orgasm." Steve snorted. "Did you now? No wonder people keep telling me not to look up my symptoms online." "It's okay if you don't want to," Tony said diplomatically. "I'm not even on the same continent as not wanting to," Steve said firmly. His hand skated over Tony's hip. "But I'd never forgive myself if I hurt you." "You won't hurt me," Tony insisted. He eased Steve into another kiss. "I'll tell you if my stitches get jostled, okay? We don't have to attempt any feats of gymnastic ability. I just want to touch you for a while." Apparently that idea was appealing because Steve rolled over until he was leaning over Tony and kissed him until his brain started dribbling out of his ears. "How about," Steve murmured against Tony's cheek. "How about if I touch you for a while?" "Shit," Tony breathed. "Yes, please." Steve slipped his hand up under Tony's shirt. "You know, after I ran into you in the library, I thought you were such an ass." Tony laughed. "And somehow now you want my ass? What changed?" Steve actually blushed, which only made him cuter. "I talked to Darcy. She obviously adored you. And the more she talked, the more I realized what a great teacher you must be to inspire that kind of adoration. Once I figured out that the actual way you and your students talked to each other wasn't disrespect, but actually quite the opposite, well, that was the beginning of a pretty steep slide into falling for you." Tony's heart started sprinting like he was finishing a marathon. He supposed maybe it kind of was. They'd been running full tilt towards each other for months now, and it was finally all coming to a head, and hopefully towards him getting some head, too. He told Steve as much, and Steve obliged by stripping Tony out of his clothes, sweetly and delicately, like he was precious. Steve traced a finger around the bandage on Tony's arm, then kissed his way down his chest. If Tony had ever imagined what sex with Dr. Grant would be like, and by now he felt fairly comfortable admitting he certainly had, more than once, this wasn't it. Steve took him apart inch by inch, methodical and thorough, and absolutely focused on his task with a strategic intensity that made it clear exactly why he'd been chosen for Project Rebirth in the first place. Instead of the athletic but disinterested role in the hay Tony had been jacking off to for an embarrassingly long time, Steve gently and unapologetically took Tony to pieces and lovingly put him back together again. Steve's hot, wet mouth turned Tony into a gasping, twitching mess that slowly pooled into a puddle of sheer satisfaction. Tony attempted to return the favor, but Steve, paragon of chivalry that he was, pinned Tony to the bed on his back and stole his own release, rutting through the mess Tony had made of his own thighs, their mouths pressed together in a perpetual open kiss. They lay together in the afterglow, watching the sun rise in red and gold through the gap in Tony's curtains. "Penny for your thoughts," Tony said, tracing an aimless swirl across Steve's chest. "Actually, since you're from 1943, I could probably get a whole week's worth of thoughts for a penny. Good investment." Steve laughed, his arm drawing Tony closer against his chest. I was thinking about your book again, actually. I'll dump the project, do something else. It's not fair to you to dig through all this like it's old news when it's your very real yesterday. What? Oh no, please don't. I know you can't write about Project Rebirth anymore, which I'm sure will be 80% of our conversation with Coulson on Monday, but if there's any way you can still write about Bucky and Peggy and the 107th, I just... He cleared his throat. It would mean a lot to me. Really? I thought it would be, I don't know, disrespectful or something. No, I think it would be beautiful to have all that immortalized. Steve was quiet for a moment, and when he started speaking again, it was softer, more distant. Everyone who remembers is gone now. All the Howleys, Peggy, Bucky, even Howard. Tony remembered with a start that his father actually knew the man he was now naked in bed with, then set the knowledge aside in a box marked Beware of Leopard, where he planned to avoid it until he could afford the kind of therapy that puts psychologist kids through college. It would be nice to keep them alive. I don't have anyone to talk to about this stuff, but if someone wrote it down, it'd be like, well, like they were still here with me. Even without Rebirth, there were all kinds of amazing strategy development going on there. Really cool stuff. I could tell you about it. I could get some stuff unredacted, probably, since you'd have security clearance. And there's some stuff I liberated from the archives when S.H.I.E.L.D. let me spend a few weeks learning what I'd missed. Letters of Peggy's and stuff. You couldn't quote them directly, but maybe it would help you with, I don't know, the flavor of it all. God, I would love to see those. S.H.I.E.L.D. would have to read your book before you submitted it, of course, but if you're still interested in writing it, I'd really like to read it. I would. I definitely would. That would be amazing. The people always interested me just as much as the tech, really, if I'm honest. Tony rested his chin on Steve's chest. So tell me, who are the Howleys? Steve grinned. He settled down on the sheets and pushed his fingers up through Tony's hair. So the Howleys, well, first of all, it was me, Bucky, Dum Dum, Marita, Jones. Tony closed his eyes and listened. Chapter 9, Epilogue. In one sense, of course, the 107th Regiment is remarkable, Tony remarked, glancing out at the faces assembled in front of him. It was just over a year since he had stood in front of the Stanley College Library and inadvertently confronted Steve with the ghost of his past. Today, he was addressing a slightly larger crowd of soon-to-be colleagues at George Washington University in D.C., about to wrap up the first talk about his completed book. The narrative of the 107th changes what we thought we knew about the course of the war, Tony continued. The men who went on to be known in private whisper networks as the Howling Commandos were deployed in an unusually wide range of military actions, worked both within and against the military order of command as they negotiated the parameters of their service and endured traumatic losses. Tony paused to display the individual deceased personnel files of James Buchanan Barnes and Stephen Grant Rogers. The second of those documents wasn't, strictly speaking, an artifact of the 20th century, but according to the SHIELD agent who had helped Tony mock it up, this wasn't the first time the organization had faked someone's death. Tony had tried very hard not to linger over the implications of that little revelation, contenting himself with dragging Coulson through only one round of dead historical figures most likely to be currently masquerading as unassuming art professors, and had instead focused on the happy fact that the secret government organization forging documents for his monograph had decades of experience in the area. On the other hand, he resumed, and this is really the crux of the argument I make in my book, the 107th isn't remarkable at all. Because as pivotal as their military engagements were, the biggest legacies they left behind are legacies they share with hundreds of thousands of people whose lives were changed irrevocably by the violence of war. The traces of an everyday existence that was both uniform and irreplaceable. Tony clicked to advance the slideshow to a photograph of a letter on Army stationery. It was signed by Dum Dum Dugan, addressed to a woman named Rosie Roberts, and placed next to a single pressed wildflower, which had been tucked into the envelope Coulson dug up from the SHIELD archives. The evidence of human relations formed under the most dehumanizing of conditions. The slide jumped to a photo of Marita, Falsworth, Jones, and Dernier, leaning against each other as they collapsed in laughter. The works of creativity that remind us of a human urge to make beauty even in the midst of great ugliness. Steve's sketch of a lavender field outside Aix-en-Provence appeared on the screen, and of course the people who loved them. Tony's eyes found Steve's at the back of the lecture hall, a move that remained as involuntary and electric as it had a year ago. Steve's face was tight, with an emotion Tony now knew how to interpret, but the lines of his forehead softened as Tony held his gaze. Countless loved ones, whose happiness and livelihoods and even survival were bound up in the everyday small-scale costs of waging war. This book is dedicated to them, and to two loved ones of members of the 107th in particular, Peggy Carter and Arnie Roth, without whose determination to preserve the story of Steve Rogers, this project would not have been possible. Tony took a final pause, remembering the day he'd driven down to Brooklyn to give Arnie the proofs for his chapter on the Howling Commandos. Steve had snuck in to hide behind a stack of books, and honestly, it was just as well that Arnie had his reading glasses on, because Steve remained as conspicuous as ever in a college library. But the risk had been worth it to give Steve the chance to see Arnie's face when he read the book's dedication for Peggy and Arnie, who never gave up and who kept the stories alive. Thank you all for your attention today, Tony finished finally. Now get out of here, will you? Go call a loved one and thank a librarian. The auditorium broke into a round of applause as Tony's new colleague, Dr. Sam Wilson, in English, got up to join him, clapping a hand to Tony's shoulder and murmuring a quick, "Congrats, man," before he leaned into the microphone. Let's thank Dr. Stark again for sharing his work with us today. You'll be able to read more about his research on the 107th in his book, Lives Behind the Lines, Minor Archives in Military History, which is under contract with Cambridge University Press. and students at GWU will have a chance to enroll in a special seminar on danger and discovery in historical research when he joins us this fall. Don't forget to grab some extra food on your way out. I'm looking at you, seniors. I know you're hungry. Do not ditch me with those extra bagels. Tony accepted a handshake from Wilson and some more polite clapping from the audience before he walked up the stage to greet Pepper, Bruce, and Rhodey. "Great talk," Pepper remarked, pulling Tony into a hug. "But if you think the last line is going to make up for leaving campus without returning my espresso machine, you have greatly overestimated my weakness for flattery." "Espresso machine? I haven't seen it. Someone must have stolen it out of my office or seized it as evidence. You know I got abducted by an organization of secret Nazis last year, right?"
"Nope," Rhodey shook his head. "This is the first I'm hearing of it. I definitely didn't have to be sworn to secrecy about the 15 phone messages you left me the day you got back, including some very explicit details about the morning after that I sincerely wish Coulson would brainwash out of me forever."
"At least you didn't get the bullet point version," Bruce pointed out. "The list of 21 reasons I'm banging my research only got shredded because I didn't have enough time to burn it before the men in black showed up."
"You're all being extremely rude to me on this, my day of glorious triumph," Tony observed.
"Yeah," Pepper agreed, squeezing Tony's arm fondly. "That's why you keep us around."
"I do," Tony said, swallowing past a lump in his throat. "I will. You and Bruce better be down here at least once a month to get shitty margaritas and tell me who's taking over Sitwell's title of most likely to use the phrase proper channels in the bedroom."
"Wouldn't miss it, bud," Bruce replied. "And we'll get you back in Boston for Darcy's honors defense. So, you know, plenty of chances for you to share your hot takes on academic Twitter's latest beefs.
You can hear some tonight when you come for dinner," Tony promised with a grin. 6:30 at our place. Don't let Rhodey choose the wine."
He clapped Bruce on the back and swanned his way toward the door, pausing to blow a kiss over his shoulder when Rhodey called out, "Just for that, I'm getting the most buttery Chardonnay I can find." Tony found Steve outside, leaning against the railing in a leather jacket and sunglasses, looking more like Han Solo than the tweed-jacketed Dr. Jones Tony had initially fallen in love with. Not that he was complaining.
"Hey, babe," he grinned and bounced down the steps to Steve, who caught him around the waist and squeezed him close. "You were great. That was amazing."
The corners of Steve's eyes were a bit pink, as if he'd had to rub them with the tissue.
"Couldn't have done it without you."
Tony gazed stupidly up at him. How did he get to have this guy? Steve smiled back. "Love you." A group of students walked past and giggled. Tony heard one of them mutter, "Get a room," and her girlfriends laughed louder. Tony laughed too. "What do you think, Cap, shall we?" He waggled his eyebrows. "About time, I'd say." Steve set off towards the car, keeping his arm around Tony's waist.
"How about 7 rooms and a terrace?"
"Charmer."
"You still have boxes to unpack."
"Moi?
What about the veritable menagerie of punching bags you have stashed in the dining room?"
"Dumb's cage is perched on top of a stack of monographs, and what I can only hope is an unopened jar of strawberry jam."
They reached the car, and Tony slid into the driver's seat. As soon as Steve had buckled in, he ran his hand down Tony's leg and squeezed his knee.
Tony kicked their new car, whom Tony had named, to Coulson's absolute dismay, Phil, into drive.
"You know very well that I need those unread books. They're here for emotional support. Besides, Dummy enjoys the adventure. He likes pretending he's a mountain climber."
"He's going to enjoy being a mountain faller quite a bit less."
"You know," Tony pointed out, "if you're going to be a backseat parent, you should just adopt him officially. Wouldn't want him to feel like one of his daddies loves him less."
"I'm fairly certain hamster custody declaration isn't actually a legal process that's available to us."
"When has legality ever stopped you?"
Steve laughed, and Tony flicked his eyes over to catch the carefree abandon on his face. God, he was so beautiful, and he was all Tony's.
"Well, there's one thing I wouldn't mind doing legally, someday," Steve mused softly, sounding almost nervous, and Tony looked at him again.
There was a quiet earnestness about him that made Tony's heart flutter. Tony cleared his throat, feeling his cheeks heat. He reached down and squeezed Steve's hand, where it still gripped his knee. "We can certainly put a pin in that. Add it to the action items for consideration. Put it on the family meeting agenda. He looked over to find Steve smile again. "I'm sure you'll have many points of order to raise." Steve chuckled. "As long as you second the motion, eventually." "Only if Dummy can be the ring bearer," Tony said, relaxing as Steve's laughter lightened the mood again. "Whatever you want, sweetheart. For now, I'll settle for milkshakes and unpacking endless boxes of incomprehensible notebooks." "Perfect." Tony turned toward Thomas Sweet. Someday indeed, someday soon, he hoped, because every day he spent with Steve was one more point in favor of forever. It was about time he started making his own history. The end.